meeting of the House Interim Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to order.
And good morning. I will call the Senate Interim Committee on Rules and Executive Appointments to order. Today we're going to have a very straightforward agenda. I believe you all have a copy of it. But I'm going to just talk briefly a little bit about the agenda for the committee overall. This committee, as you know, was formed at the request of both the Senate President and the Speaker. This is not actually a joint committee, but a joint meeting of two separate committees. Our purpose is to review SB 10, landmark legislation, ethics legislation from our last regular session, and our hope is to probably address some of the concerns that have come forward about that legislation. I think anytime you put forward landmark legislation, you sometimes have some collateral impacts that you need to address, and you need to make some refinements to that legislation. Our intent here is to meet here today. We have invited testimony today. We are planning a hearing sometime in the foreseeable future in the eastern portion of the state, probably in Pendleton. Then we will come back here to Salem for another hearing. At that hearing, we will also have an opportunity for open public testimony. We may or may not actually also have an opportunity for remote hearing locations at that meeting. So, instance, we might be able to have maybe a meeting site in Medford or something like that, in which people could actually have an opportunity to testify, or maybe even a couple other areas in the state, while we are here taking testimony in Salem for that third meeting. We'll then come back for a fourth meeting, which will be to consider basically a discussion of potential options. We don't know if that committee meeting will reach resolution. If not, we will go into a fifth committee meeting, which should be the final meeting of this committee. We have kind of different assignments as rules committees. Mine, this particular interim, is primarily limited to this and to executive appointments. Representative Rosenbaum has the normal broad assignments of a rules committee, including all elections issues and other issues, so she needs more time to actually do those things, whereas I don't think any of you would want to sit through executive appointments either. But
be careful what you wish for.
But at that, I'm going to turn the gavel back over to Representative Rosenbaum, who will take over for the first portion of this meeting.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. And as the Senator has just said, we will be hearing today invited testimony only. I just want to make it clear again that there will be ample opportunity for members of the public who wish to comment either on the report that we're receiving this morning or other problems that they want to bring to the committee's attention. So I see we have a full complement of House members. Representative Shields is going to be joining us, I believe, in about an hour. He had a medical appointment to take care of. And we have senators who are here, too. So without further ado, I will call forward the Ethics Reform Team, and that would be Dexter Johnson. And, Dexter, I believe you were bringing with you a complement of colleagues and associates, Marjorie Taylor, Phil Schradel, and Kelly Skye. And, members, I believe that you have in front of you the written report of the Ethics Reform Review Team, and this was made available to committee members. I don't know if you had a chance to eyeball it before this morning, but we'll have ample opportunity. And I'd like to let our witnesses go through the report so that we get a chance to hear everything that's in it before we open it up for questions. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Devlin, and members. I'm Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel, and with me is Phil Schradel from the Department of Justice, Marjorie Taylor from the Department of Administrative Services, and Kelly Skye from the Governor's Office. And collectively, we are your Ethics Reform Review Team. You and legislative leadership and the Governor's Office gathered us together in mid-April to... with the task of examining the 2007 ethics reform legislation and gathering for you some factual information about it and concerns that members of the public and public officials have with that, and synthesize that in a report. I believe you all have the report in front of you, and today we're here basically to go through and touch on highlights of that report. And so that's what we're going to do. And so I'd like to turn to the report, and the first few pages are actually kind of background information on historically what ethics law in Oregon was like, and the process that led up to the 2007 reforms. And I'll certainly let you review that at your leisure, but I do want to highlight what I think are a couple of significant facts for you just to keep in mind. First is the 1974 legislation, which was the first comprehensive ethics law in Oregon, was a legislative referral to voters, and it, or actually companion legislation, contained a very interesting provision that allowed public officials from cities or counties that the voters of which did not approve the 74 legislation, it exempted them from the public reporting requirements that public officials otherwise were to comply with. Just we'll return to that fact in a few minutes, so just keep that in mind. The other thing I'd like to note is that basically this process began with a direction from Governor Kulongoski to the Oregon Law Commission in 2005 to have the Law Commission comprehensively review the ethics laws and make recommendations to you in 2007. The feeling at the time was the laws were more than 30 years old, but had been amended in one form or another in virtually almost all sessions between 1974 and 2003, and there was some lack of consistency, kind of piecemeal effect of these various discrete amendments was taking its toll on the overall operation of the ethics law. And so the governor directed the Law Commission to take a comprehensive look at ethics laws and come up with some recommendations. The Law Commission did so, and in 2007 presented actually 10 recommendations, 10 different proposed drafts for you to consider. You spent a lot of time in 2007 looking at them and a number of other proposals, enacted some proposals that were of your own, and the result has been what we collectively in this report call the 2007 reforms. Significantly, I think neither the Law Commission nor you in 2007 spent a lot of time focusing on the public official reporting requirements, the statement of economic interest and the quarterly reporting requirements. There were changes made, and those were enacted, but I don't think, compared with a number of the other changes, there was a significant amount of attention paid to them at the both at the Law Commission level and then in front of the legislature. So with that background, let me turn to kind of what our process was once you and legislative leadership convened us. We met with representatives of the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, Confederation of School Administrators, Special District Association, Port of Portland, and City of Portland, and gathered comments from them on the 2007 reforms. We met actually twice with the Government Ethics Commission to discuss their process. We met with the Oregon Law Commission, and they provided a lot of background information to us. And then we sent out a letter soliciting comments, and it went basically through email listservs from the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, the Department of Administrative Services list for state agencies, and the legislature's own listserv for that anyone can sign up for if you're interested in committee agendas and other activities of the legislature. As a result of that letter, we received, I believe it's 268 public comments, and they are pointing in the direction of these binders over here. They are there for your review, in addition to materials submitted by the Ethics Commission and by the Law Commission and other comments that were sent directly to the governor's office. We've synthesized those comments in this report, and I will go through that in a minute. But first, I guess let me turn to kind of the Government Ethics Commission and its activities from the period at the from the end of the legislative session through May of this year. And I'm beginning here on page 5 of the report, and you might want to turn to that. The first thing I'll touch upon is the expansion of the Ethics Commission. They were, as of July 2007, an agency of 3 people, and you authorized, through the budget process, you authorized them to expand their staff, and they did so. You will see in the middle of the page there their staffing changes and a number of the basically the staff doubled in size. Those positions were not funded for the entire biennium, however, and they hired consistently with your funding of them, which was a kind of a staggered rollout throughout the biennium. I'll also note that the commission during this process in the early fall moved, in part also because of the staff expansion, from their previous offices to new offices out in South Salem. So what during this period, what were their activities besides the move and hiring staff? One of the significant functions of the commission undertook during the fall and early spring was training of public officials, local government, and state officials for that matter. They undertook 17 training sessions during the fall and an additional 19 during the spring of the year. And basically these were when a local government or a group or something like that would ask the commission to perform a training, they would agree to do so and did so. Their next significant activity was the adoption of rules. They began that process in October of 2007 through the creation of an advisory committee that took materials originally prepared by the Law Commission, and they worked through that and then conducted formal, adopted temporary rules at the end of the year, conducted formal rulemaking hearings and work session in the spring, in the early spring of 2008, and then adopted permanent rules on March 5th of 2008. There, we received a fair number of comments. The commission rulemaking process was extensive, though we did also receive a fair number of comments that from affected individuals that they had wished that there was more opportunity for further discussion with the commission of what the rules were going to provide. The other thing I will note about the rules is that while they have covered a number of areas of the laws and provided rulemaking further guidance through rules, there are also significant parts of the 2007 reforms that are still where there probably would be a need for rules, and those rules are not yet out there.
Okay, so that then brings me to the other significant activity that the Ethics Commission engaged in beginning actually January 15, 2008, and that was the preparation and distribution of the Statement of Economic Interest, the SEI form, and the first companion quarterly public official disclosure form. They began that process in January of 2008 by conducting outreach to what they consider to be contact individuals in the various local and state governments where there are public officials to identify who the public officials are who are required to file the forms. And that process began in January. I'll note that the commission has historically always and continues to do so printed specifically addressed forms and mail them to public officials required to file the forms. They do not permit public officials to self-identify as individuals who are required to file and just go ahead and file anyways. Their concern about that is that it would make there would be many people who would file who would not need to file, and there would be individuals who needed to file who would not file. And so they are concerned that if you will permit self-identification, they're going to have a much more challenging time identifying who the individuals are who have not filed, who are required to file. So that process began in mid-January, but went on for actually a long time, at least through the end of February. In part because, and this is where I'm going to go back to that historical fact that I first talked about, under the 74 laws, certain cities and counties did not require, or the state law did not require that they make any reports. And in 2007, you eliminated that requirement so that, in fact, there were six counties and 81, I think, eighty-one cities. And there's a list, by the way, at the end of the report of the cities that had never before been subject to reporting requirements who, as a result of the 2007 laws, suddenly were. The experience of the Ethics Commission was that that was a it was quite challenging for them to reach out to these new cities and counties and get the information on who these new public officials were who would be required to report. There was a lot of resistance from at the entity level from cities and counties in identifying who the individuals were, and so it took them a long time to get that information. As I mentioned, the SEI forms have pre-printed names and addresses so that you're not allowed to self-identify. And there's kind of a cascading effect that the Ethics Commission experienced because it took them so long to get lists of who these new public officials were. That delayed the printing. That delayed the distribution. And so there ended up being a long period of time where these new cities and counties were aware something was going on, but they weren't quite sure what it was. And this is the what I will call the period of misinformation, where there was a lot of news reports, but not particularly accurate. We have found, though, that by the time people got around to reporting, they actually had even the new public officials for which this was a brand new experience, they had a pretty good idea of what the facts were. So there was a lot period of misinformation, but by the time people were getting around to filing, I think that the information, public understanding was fairly accurate. So the forms went out, eventually got out very right around April 1st, and this was with an April 15 filing deadline, and so there was there were some forms that went out before that. I shouldn't say all of them went out just April 1st, but there was a very quick turnaround time, and that also fed into what was generally a very high degree of anxiety on the part of public officials. And we will summarize the kind of the comments. Most of the comments that we received, the vast majority of them, were about the SEI and quarterly reporting. I'll get to summarize that. But I think before I get there, I just want to go through a few statistics there on page 8 of the report. The forms were mailed to individuals, 5,509, on or before April 1st. And as you can see in from the second paragraph, there were, as of May 20th, there were approximately twice the number of what would be normal, of forms that were filed for which there was some problem. There was either information that was withheld, information that the answer was ambiguous, or was not timely, or the report was not timely filed. So there was approximately twice as many as normal for which there was some problem. And in addition to that, as of May 22nd, 2008, the commission believes there were 203 public officials who had resigned. The vast majority of them, though not, it's not clear that all of them were because of reaction to reforms, but certainly the majority of them were resignations driven by the forms and by objections to the forms. All right, with that, I'm going to turn to, I think, the comments that we received. As I noted before, they're in these five binders over there. There are 268 comments, plus additional comments the governor's office received directly. And those actually comprise three of the five binders. The remaining two are Law Commission materials and Ethics Commission materials. And as I noted, the overwhelming... I wouldn't say overwhelming, but the majority of comments, at least 75%, were about the SEI and quarterly reporting forms. There were a large number of comments about other aspects of the ethics reforms as well. I'll note that most of those comments were actually from association representatives and professional lobbyists and that category of individuals, whereas the vast majority of comments from local governments were from small rural local governments, government officials, and individuals, and were directed towards the SEI and quarterly reporting forms and their objections to them. And far and away, of that group, far and away, the biggest objection was to the listing of relatives on the form. That was overwhelmingly the number one objection. And there were several, parsing that out, there were several components to it. One, public officials were concerned about public safety and disclosing the names of individuals who did not sign up to be public officials, and there was concerns about public safety as because they would then these individuals would be associated with public officials who frequently are targets of harassment or worse. Also concern about identity theft, just in general, both for public officials and but particularly for their relatives. The feeling was that by publicly listing them like this would make them more likely to be targets of identity theft. There was also some much more, I think, personal concerns that some comments raised. For example, a number of people said, you know, these are relatives, but I'm estranged from them, and by having to list them, this kind of brings up personal stress for me, and I don't. Another overwhelming comment was, we don't see the relevance of what our relatives have to do with our functions as public officials, particularly relatives who are out of state, sometimes out of the country. Finally, this in the context of the listing of relatives, but also a general comment raised about the forms was a feeling of intrusiveness into the private lives of these public officials, and concerns again about harassment, also concerns about that these forms require the disclosure of personal finance and business interests, and I'll note there was considerable misinformation previously about, you know, you just would require disclosure of amounts of investments and things like that, which the forms do not do. But there was a lot of misinformation about that, but by the time we got to looking at this and the comments people were making, they understood that, but nevertheless raised concerns about, if I disclose business partners, that may, for example, create competitive challenges for those business partners. And again, they didn't sign up to be public officials. An example of that. A number of comments, I would say this is actually the number two concern, was the impact that these requirements, these filing requirements, would have on volunteers. These are people who do not receive compensation for the work that they do. Volunteers are crucial in small local governments, that they perform the vast majority of policymaking and decision-making roles there. And the feeling was that having to comply with these reporting requirements triggered a lot of those folks to resign, and I think more significantly created going forward a fairly substantial hurdle for the government to recruit new talented volunteers. It's always a challenge that in small communities, and this certainly makes that even more of a challenge, was what many comments said. Another big concern was, and this is something that, first of all, isn't taking place now, but under the law is scheduled to take place in 2010, and that is the posting of this information in a searchable database that is accessible over the Internet. That, if you'll note, that ties directly in with almost all of the concerns I've previously raised and magnifies it. There was a fair amount of knowledge that this was not going on right now, but great concern that in 2010 there would be a searchable database out there by which you could access this information anonymously. And I'll just, many comments noted the distinction between that and the public records request. These forms, as you all know, are public records right now. But in order for someone to access them, they have to file a public records request, which itself is a public record, so that you as a SEI filer can figure out who's been looking at this. And that is, they saw that to be qualitatively different from a searchable Internet database where remotely and anonymously anyone can go and review the information. Big distinction there. Another theme, and this is certainly was mainly raised in the SEI context, but also was raised generally, was a feeling that there is a presumption, however inaccurate, that the SEI reporter has done something wrong, and it's because they've done something wrong that they're being asked to file out this form. It is not necessarily a rational presumption, but it is one that many comments made, and it, along with the fact that there was a presumption that there's a lack of trust here, and they felt that, particularly the volunteers felt that, well, this simply isn't warranted, and it didn't leave them with a good feeling. To put it mildly. Judges, we received a number of comments from judges, and I'll highlight them in their own category. They, more than any other group, judges and district attorneys, have some serious, significant safety concerns. They deal with high-impact emotional issues, criminal trials, domestic relations matters. They are often exposed to significant security risks. Their relatives ordinarily aren't, but this form, the feeling was that in fact exposes their relatives to the same heightened risk, and the relatives didn't sign up for that. Not just one, but actually four or five of the judges highlighted a tragic case that had come out of Chicago, where a federal judge was involved in some kind of a criminal matter, and the defendant had directed, the end result was the judge's husband and mother were murdered by at the direction of the criminal defendant. So the judges feel that this safety concern is real, and that this SEI form really raises the stakes on that. Rural local governments, they raised some, I think, particular concerns. One was the feeling that this was a transposing of urban values into rural areas. The feeling there, to put it generally, is, well, we all know what each other's activities are in these small communities, and it is we're the best judge of what's appropriate and what isn't appropriate. Also, kind of a real resentment that, you know, the 74 law permitted this exception if as a community you decided you didn't want this, that you in fact wouldn't have it. And they were very aware of that provision and the fact that the perception is, well, now Salem has come along and overridden the will of local voters. And so that also caused a fairly significant amount of resentment. I think those are the significant SEI and quarterly report concerns, a few others that you can look at. As I noted, we received comments on other aspects of the 2007 reforms as well. Most of those, I'm pretty confident you have heard a lot of in detail. They're listed here on pages 10 and 11. A couple of them I will flag because I think they're broader than just pointing at particular provisions and saying there's a problem with this. One is the recognition that a lot of local governments, local and state governments, and government agencies, local governments and state agencies, or government entities and nonprofit organizations, they all have shared missions. And being able to collaborate in achieving those missions is a real value for them. And the ethics reforms, and here we're talking mainly about gifts and entertainment limitations and that sort of thing, really serve as a hurdle to these
government entities collaborating to achieve the mission that they're all charged with achieving. And finally, I'll note that there, with the overall ethics changes, in addition to the reforms, there's a real sense of intrusiveness that these, you know, you have to think when you're going out on a date with somebody who works for somebody who may have legislative or administrative interests with the entity that you work for. You have to think about that. You have to think about that if your son or daughter is going to a birthday party at somebody else's child's house, and you know, what does the parent do, and is there a relationship there that you need to be concerned about? So there's a real sense of intrusiveness into the private lives that permeates this. I think the other comments, as I noted, they're listed there for you to review. And with that, I'll turn things over to Kelly, who's going to walk you through the options that we've laid out in this report. I'll note that these are just some options and not any attempt at the entire universe of options for you to choose from.
And I think before we go to you, Kelly, we'll just entertain maybe a few brief questions just to clarify anything that has just been presented in the report. And I believe Representative Berger has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dexter, your mention of judges interests me. Were judges added under this, or is it just the new internet requirement that's bothering them?
It was the addition of relatives that was new. They have been subject to reporting, but it was the addition of relatives.
Okay.
Go ahead. So the judges were already in, even in the jurisdictions that were not under this 1974 laws. In other words, there were no new judges added under the provisions of this statute. It's simply the added disclosure that's bothersome to the judges.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, yes. The judges are state officials.
Yes. Thank you.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given the lateness of the mailing of some of these reports, was there any kind of grace period provided for people who turned in their reports late? You had, I forget, 200 and some, or maybe more than that were turned in late. Did these people get fines slapped on them just for being late?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, no. Not initially, though. I think a number of these situations are still outstanding. They received a letter, but at some point, a number of these filers have subsequently affirmatively said, well, this is the information you're getting, and those are still outstanding issues for the Ethics Commission. But as an initial matter, no.
And Senator Burdick, after we hear from the presenters of the review team, we will be hearing from the Ethics Commission, so we'll have a chance to ask that from them. And Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, just to clarify one thing, the judges previously have had to report a statement of economic interest. But are they subject to the Ethics Commission separately from their being subject to the Judicial Fitness Commission? I don't believe they are.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. They have their own. They actually have both the standards of the Code of Professional Responsibility that applies to all lawyers and a separate code for that applies just to judges in addition to the ethics laws of the state, and a number of judges noted that in fact the ethics standards for lawyers and for judges are in many respects stricter than the state ethics laws in general.
Mm-hmm.
So they have three levels of
follow up. I mean, maybe the terminology is synonymous in a sense, but my limited understanding of the situation a judge would be in if we use something that's analogous to a legislative or administrative interest. In most cases, wouldn't they have to recuse themselves? if they had a direct interest in the case that was before them.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I'll note one correction. The judges are exempt from gift restrictions.
Because their restrictions are higher than ours.
Right.
Yeah.
Final follow-up.
Yes, please.
One of the things in your report that you didn't comment on, which is sort of like the deep well, is the definition of legislative and administrative interest. Can you comment a little bit on some of the issues in your discussions about that? Because for those that have, of us that have filled out these forms now for 24, 25 years, that is probably the area that causes people to discuss this issue with us the most frustration, ambiguity. I mean, I've had members that have significantly more holdings than I have who have actually had to bring in their attorneys and their accountants to try to determine what if they had an administrative or legislative interest. Also, I compare it to somewhat like what we see in committees and what we see on the House and Senate floor all the time when people call rise to declare a conflict of interest when in truth it does not meet the requirement for being a conflict of interest. What are your suggestions relative to the definition of administrative and legislative interest?
And I don't mean to suggest that question is untimely, but I know that the next presenter is going to be presenting their recommendations. So
I think they may have. Let me see if they. I can't remember if you made a specific recommendation in that area. I know you used some alternatives, but if the presenter would cover that area and cover it a little bit more fully. Because I think that's one of the long-term issues with SEIUs in terms of public officials.
FEIs.
No, just a little slip there. Just a little slip there. But I think that is an issue that constantly causes questions to arise. And I was a little bit concerned about the comment about whether or not something was filled out fully or accurately or how it should be filled out, because I don't think anybody wants this to get to the level of CNE reporting, which we have to issue a book that's this thick to try to define every aspect under which you might have to report something. So I'm just curious about the administrative and legislative interest.
So we'll ask Kelly to emphasize that when she does her presenting. I did have a couple of clarifications, too. One is that in 1974, this legislation that you keep referring to, my understanding is that was a legislative referral to the voters. And just to clarify or make sure I understand, it specifically in the referral said that in entities of voters that voted no on this, counties and cities, they would not have to comply with this law?
Madam Chair, first off, it was actually in companion legislation, not in the referral itself, because that would, I'm not sure the legalities of that, but, and it was not the overall ethics law, it was merely the reporting requirements.
And just that is a fairly unusual provision in my experience, having been here for 10 years now, and things that are put in front of voters, I've never seen that before. So
yes,
I think that might have been why the Law Commission had recommended making that change. So, okay, and I guess the one other thing I wanted to make sure I understood is when we solicited comments, or you did, you sent a letter to all of the filers of this form asking them to comment. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, actually, because of the expense of that, we substituted that for requesting and both LOC and AOC complied with this, requesting that they distribute our letter on their email listservs. We did send letters to all legislators directly, but everything else was done by email listservs of LOC, AOC, the Department of Administrative Services for agents, state agencies, and the legislature's own listserv that people who are interested in legislative matters sign up for.
And we'll be hearing from those organizations, I think, after your testimony. And finally, in sort of along the lines of Senator Devlin's question about things that you didn't bring up, the lack of uniformity in who must report under the SEI requirements, could you just comment on that provision?
That issue was raised actually by a number of people submitting comments, and it basically recognizes that, for example, school boards are not required to file, and there are many school boards that are significantly larger than many of these smaller rural cities and counties. They're not required to file. Most, though not all, most special districts are also not required to file. And again, some of those are major government operations. And finally, there's the statute lists agency directors pretty much by position, and that list is omits some agencies as well. I think the largest being the Department of Corrections.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman?
Yes, Senator Farrioli.
I have a couple questions.
Yes, please go ahead.
First, a comment relative to a question that was brought up by Senator Burdick when she asked whether any of the non-filers had been fined, and it was mentioned that they had received a letter from the Ethics Commission. I think it would be beneficial to the committee members to see a copy of that correspondence, because it threatens legal action and fines. We, as legislators, considering this legislation in our committees in the Senate and I think in the House, were assured that the Ethics Commission would not be in an enforcement mode, but rather be in an education mode, until it was reasonably certain that we had some kinks ironed out in what would inevitably be a confusing and complicated change in the law. And I received comments and copies of those nasty grams, as I call them, from folks that got them, and they were threatening. I just wanted people to understand that I think it'd be beneficial if we could get copies of that correspondence from committee members. Madam Chair, I wanted to comment on the question about the urban-rural issue, because almost all the jurisdictions that exempted themselves from the law, as was their right to do by the terms of the referral, are in Eastern Oregon. And I just wanted to point out that, you know, in communities where you have a municipal population under 200 people, that getting folks to serve in any capacity in the city council or the planning commission or any of the other boards and commissions where we redefine folks as public officials is difficult. And I guess I've heard the characterization that urban standards were being applied to rural folks. I want people to understand that there is sort of a prevailing sense that if people are in public service or are politicians, we can put quotes around that. At the root of that might be a motivation for some sort of personal gain. And the tone and tenor and the requirements for reporting and the inclusion of family members and the sort of broadening of the scope of reporting seems to send the message that people are, in fact, only in public service for some kind of personal gain, and that these FEI forms are designed to somehow confirm that, smoke that out. So I just wanted to point that out. And then, Madam Chairman, I am ready to ask my question of Deputy Johnson, if he's still available.
Yes, we're waiting for your question, Senator. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Dexter, we asked the chairman of the commission in several times during the session to make sure we had a log of the kinds of questions that people were asking and the answers that the commission was providing, so that we'd have a growing body of precedent that we could refer to help people understand the parameters. And yet, so I'd like to ask you if you have asked the commission for that log and their responses to sort of guide us in, the kind of administrative history we're creating as an underpinning for this ethics law.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, we asked the commission for all relevant kind of information, and we had concerning their activities from July 2007 through May of this year. We had we had two meetings with them, and they discussed certainly their that one of the substantial tasks they were undertaking was answering specific questions, and it was very challenging for them. However, I was unaware of a log, and I don't think any of the other team members were aware of a log of specific questions. We certainly were not provided that.
And once again, we will be hearing from the Ethics Commission shortly. And I believe Senator Brown may have a question for you, Senator Ferrioli, if you are willing to entertain it.
Oh, Madam Chair, I'd love to, after I finish asking Mr. Johnson a follow-up question.
Okay, go ahead.
And I guess, Madam Chair, if such a log isn't being kept, that is a tragedy beyond measure, because every one of the questions and every one of the responses is a public document, and they all must be kept, and they all must be available for public inspection, and if a FOIA request is necessary, I think we should file one. But the other fact that I wonder if Mr. Johnson would confirm for me is that often the commission has refused to answer questions from elected public officials relative to rendering an opinion about an issue.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, there was considerable comments on the part of many individuals that they were not getting the guidance that they were seeking in a timely fashion from the Ethics Commission. There was certainly the Ethics Commission is making they explained to us that is one of their significant roles that they have been undertaking over the past 6 months, is to provide that information, and that approximately half of the staff spends most of the time providing informal advice, though the formal written advice that has been asked for many times is not forthcoming at the moment, because they, in part, their resources have been in this kind of cascading fashion been directed first on kind of logistics, like moving, hiring people, then rulemaking, and then rolling out the SEI, and training was in there as well. So they are aware that providing both informal and formal advice is a significant function, and they are doing that to the extent they can, but a number of comments made were we're not getting timely advice on what to do with these situations.
Madam Chair, I appreciate and Mr. Johnson, thank you for your answer. Madam Chair, I appreciate that. Very politic answer. The fact is that I've had reports where people have asked for clarification, provided really specific case-by-case kinds of questions, and they either get, as Dr. Johnson said, either an untimely response, but more often no response at all. And, I just guess that, to me, it seems very difficult to understand how it is that we have an ethics commission that's supposed to be guiding folks on how to apply the new standards that either cannot or will not respond. And yes, Madam Chair, I am ready to answer Senator Brown's question.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. And we are going to need to move on pretty quickly here, but I believe Phil Schradl might have a comment on your last question as well.
Yes, Chair Rosenbaum, thank you. Senator Ferrioli, in the report, we do note that the executive director indicated to us that between the time of January 1, 2008, and I think sometime in March, that the staff had provided at least 200 written pieces of advice to respond to questions. That doesn't cover the time frame in the fall or earlier. We didn't specifically ask in our review process for copies of those, but I'm certain that the Government Ethics Commission staff, we know, would be happy to respond to questions addressed to them.
And Senator Brown, please go ahead.
Thanks, Senator Ferrioli, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but since you raised the issue, I'm going to have you respond. I've reviewed the letters from public officials around the state regarding the new reporting requirements, and they seem to have two concerns. One is our communities voted no in 1974 to complying with this SEI reporting form, and so we shouldn't have to 30 years later, and the other is we're very small and it's very difficult. And I guess what I'd like you to respond, I'm troubled by the fact I don't see the vote in 1974 as controlling for us in 2007, given everything that's changed. And I guess, to me, the better approach, if we were going to look at exempting out jurisdictions, and I don't know whether the committee's going there at all anyway, but if we were going to exempt out jurisdictions, wouldn't the better approach for consistency and uniformity around the state be toward exempting out jurisdictions of a particular size? I guess I'm asking you, voters opposing it in 1974 isn't very persuasive. Can you articulate a reason why we should exempt out those jurisdictions over 30 years later?
No, Senator Brown. It's not so much that folks, I didn't make the argument about the will of the people. I understand from time to time things change. The issue that I wanted to point out is that in many of these jurisdictions, the pool to draw from within a jurisdiction is so small that anything that discourages public service impedes those jurisdictions to the point where they simply cannot function. I've had several jurisdictions where the entire planning commission has quit, and that kicks the planning issues up to either the jurisdiction itself. Many of the members of those jurisdictions also have resigned. And I think it's before the smoke all clears on this thing, I've got a couple of counties that are responsible for doing municipal management, including the jurisdiction over the town and the jurisdiction over the planning. That was a predictable result of the modifications that we were making. And if you remember, Senator Brown, Senator David Nelson, and myself said, look, this is just going to precipitate, mass exodus of the elected public officials in rural Oregon. And I'm frankly surprised that it's only been 203. I think every quarter you're going to see more people who receive those forms say, look, this is too much, for me to have to do. It's difficult and demanding to serve. I take a lot of heat for it. And all you got to do, Senator and colleagues, is look at the number of recall petitions that are filed in Oregon every year and look at the basis on which those are filed. Almost never is there a substantive reason for a recall. It's always a decision somebody doesn't agree with or a personality. But my goal here is to figure out a mechanism by which people can be sort of either convinced that this is not as intrusive, or the system needs to be re-engineered so that it's not as intrusive as it perceived to be. Or we do, in fact, as the good senator suggests, find a mechanism, perhaps based on the size of the jurisdiction or the population of the jurisdiction, that allows communities to opt out, by some mechanism if that's possible. No, Madam Chair, I to the senator's question, I don't know that a vote in 1974 is the issue, but I do know most of the jurisdictions that were accepted are in early in Oregon, and there was a perception in those communities that, you know, we changed the rules without inviting their guests.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. And actually, I think it probably at some point would be interesting for members of the committee to actually see the list, because a number of these communities are not in eastern Oregon. They're in the valley. A number of them are quite large in size now because obviously the population has redistributed itself and grown since 1974. And I think we're going to need to move on, but Dexter, please go ahead, and then we'll move on to the next presentation.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a footnote to your last comment. The list of communities, cities, and counties that were exempt and that no longer are is one of the pages in the back of the report.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you. And Kelly, would you like to go ahead?
Sure. Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Skye, and I'm General Counsel to Governor Kulongoski. I'd like to thank you for inviting me to participate in this review team. I'm going to present on the options that are presented in the report, and their options for consideration by your committee and eventually the Legislative Assembly. And we were specifically asked not to make recommendations, but to identify options for consideration and be prepared to talk about what the potential consequences or ramifications of those options would be. And so that's what we did, and that's what we're prepared to respond to today. The options begin on page 12 of the report, and they start with, again, the most controversial of the new requirements, which was the listing of relatives on the Statement of Economic Interest form. And in light of all the concerns that you've heard, the privacy and safety concerns, we felt that this was an area that was worth analysis, at least worth looking at sort of what benefit you get out of the listing of relatives on the form in exchange for the concerns that it raises among public officials. And so there are a number of options. And certainly on all of these options, the first option is always no action. And I didn't list that here, but that's always your option. So for the listing of relatives, you could just delete the requirement entirely if you find that the concerns that are raised outweigh the usefulness of the information. One note is that we found from the comments, people's concerns about the listing of relatives, that there was generally not an understanding of the purpose for requiring the listing. Mm-hmm. And we sort of heard two reasons for requiring it. One is that certainly these relatives are bound by the gift limits and restrictions that are listed in the statute. And so it's an opportunity, one, for lobbyists or persons with a legislative or administrative interest who are giving gifts to be able to find out who is a relative and who they're prohibited from giving gifts to. And two was that these are people who are also involved in conflict of interest determinations on behalf of the public official. It's an opportunity for the public official to review their list of relatives and go through that thought process. One of the options that was raised by a number of people with concerns, primarily with privacy concerns, was to restrict the list of relatives that are required to be listed to those who are at least in your jurisdiction, so that you're not reporting on your relatives on the East Coast who likely have nothing to do with your duties as a public official, or to restrict the list to a list of relatives who have a legislative or administrative interest in the agency that you work for. Another approach would be to create an exemption for filing the list of relatives for public officials who express a safety concern, and that could be something that you could provide statutory authority for the commission to create rules for a process for applying for an exemption. You also could just statutorily exempt certain public officials from that relative listing requirement based on their specific position, such as judges and district attorneys who have the very clear public safety concerns. But there are other folks who express public safety concerns on the basis of having experienced harassment as a result of their duties as a public official, and so it's somewhat difficult to define that by position. The last option that's listed there is simply to direct the Government Ethics Commission to include in the explanation the purpose of this reporting requirement, so that people understand what the purpose is when they're filling it out.
I don't mean to set a bad example by interrupting you myself, but
she's going to.
But I'm going to do it anyway. So it seems like there'd be an additional option of requiring that the information be reported, but simply exempt it from public disclosure the way we do in some other kinds of public documents, like people's driver's license records for certain categories of people are exempt from access by people who are seeking that information.
And Chair Rosenbaum, that is indeed an option. I will tell you that the Government Ethics Commission has some concerns, just practically speaking, how they would go about exempting that material. I know right now, specifically for the judges who have asked that information not be disclosed, they've just set those aside to ensure that they don't disclose it without going through some legal process that would need to before determining whether they could disclose it. It's not entirely simple to just exempt a specific piece of information, so it might mean that you have to create a separate sheet for that listing that is kept in a different place or kept in such a way that it would be clear that it was exempt from disclosure. But that is another option.
Okay. Well, please go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. The second area of concern was the posting of the statements of economic interest on the Internet, and that did raise significant concerns, especially when paired with the listing of relatives. And so I think that those two together were probably the number one concern. So there are a number of things that you could do there. The first one is just to go back to the system that we had before. Eliminate the requirement that the SEIs be placed on the Internet, but maintain them as a public record as they are currently. And I think Dexter covered sort of how that would work. The second thing that you could do is you could still post the SEIs on a searchable database, but you could restrict the information that's actually accessible on the searchable database and not include the relatives, and consider not including some of the other pieces of information that were concerning for individuals. And the third suggestion was that you place some type of security measure on the website so that not just anybody could access the website, but that there was some having to input information that you're accessing a person's SEI, so that there was some idea of who was accessing this information. So those were three ideas. And I will say that the posting on the Internet is in some ways linked to a concept which actually did receive some favorable comments, which is allowing for electronic filing. And that would really simplify the filing requirement for a lot of people. There are some concerns that perhaps not everybody would have access to a computer to do that, but it certainly would simplify the paperwork, and it would also, for the Ethics Commission, greatly reduce the resources that they spend processing all this paper. So that part of it people really seem to like. It was the end result of the searchable database that caused the concern. The disclosure of real property, that was a concern primarily from people who work in real estate, that they may have an option to buy or sell a piece of property, and by having to disclose all of this on an SEI, it may put them at a competitive disadvantage in their business. And so the only option really that we came up with for that one was rather than requiring the specific address of the property to list that a person actually owned property in a specific city and what type of property that was, whether it was a single family dwelling rental or a piece of property that was eligible for development. The next section, this is actually a relatively small one, the listing of the five most significant sources of income. This filing requirement, as you may recall, used to be on the SEIs, and it set out a number of different percentages. Report the income that is between this percentage and this percentage of your income. And it was somewhat complicated and required a lot of mathematics. And so the idea on behalf of the Law Commission was to make that easier. Let's just list the five most significant sources. Where this raised concern was that there are a lot of people who don't have five significant sources of income, and so they went searching. And my favorite quote was the person who said, "Well, my third source was my garage sale, and my retirement was that." And it also then gets people down to a level where they might be reporting interest income on a checking or savings account, which then reveals the bank that you bank at, combined with the listing of relatives where you might get a mother's maiden name. That sort of raised some security issues. So the simple option that we came up with here is just to put a floor on that amount of income so that you're only really getting the significant income that you wanted. But there's just no definition to what is significant, and that caused a lot of concern for folks. There were some people who recommended that you limit the reporting to sources of income related to your employment, and that you not be required to list investment income. So the next section is just the expansion of the SEI filing requirement to cities and counties that opted out. As you can see, I think we've talked about that quite a bit, and we did actually list a number of options. You know, the first is just to go back to the way it was and allow the folks to opt out. What we included within this section and the options that we included, because it has to do with the consistency of who's required to report, we did include in as option number two to add some of the folks who are not required to file statements of economic interest, who such as some of the special districts and state agency directors that currently aren't required. Then option number four is what you were suggesting earlier, which is to exempt very small jurisdictions from SEI reporting requirements, and you could pick a population number from which you could exempt. The other thing is to another approach would be to exempt volunteer public officials from certain agencies or certain local governments. So there are two sort of approaches to restricting that if you wanted to restrict it. And I think it's the population or their volunteer status or their decision-making status. So a lot of people who complain about having to file an SEI said, "Well, I don't have any decision-making authority. I'm a volunteer. I don't get compensated. You know, why should I have to do this?" So that would be a place you could focus it as well.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Berger had a question about that.
Did you consider elected officials only as opposed to, because it isn't specified here. In other words, exempting everyone who isn't an elected official.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, you know, we didn't consider that, and we certainly can add an option.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
That brings into another thought process. When you make it just elect officials, you could be sitting on a planning commission and have some great conflicts. So I don't, you know, I understand what we're doing, and I think it's fine in that respect. Clarification is what's interesting here, and the fact that the biggest thing is, of course, the family. Then we talk about people that are close within your jurisdiction and or what you service, and that would be the state of Oregon. Well, we're Oregonians. All my family except two are live in Oregon, and those would be the ones that would have the repercussions of anyone that wanted to, like a judge, a security situation. So there's a lot of things we need to discuss here, but I think we're on the right track here. I really do.
Thanks for your comment, Representative. Please go ahead.
The one further comment just after in sitting here thinking about Representative Berger's suggestion of just elected officials, I would point out that a number of the SEI filers are actually appointed officials, and so it just might take a little bit more definition than just elected officials.
Absolutely.
And So our next area is quarterly public official disclosure forms. And these forms drew a lot of concerns and complaints, in part in because they're just another filing requirement, and in part because they're a little bit different and they are required so much more frequently. And the primary concern with these is that it's somewhat burdensome to file quarterly. And as we mentioned earlier, there are 5,509 filers. And at this point, we have reduced the amount of, we have reduced the gifts and expenses to a level that there's not a lot to report quarterly. And so the combination between, I guess I'll back up a little bit. The Oregon Law Commission, when they looked at this, they decided to allow, they actually, I think, recommended to increase the gift limit, but to allow meals and travel expenses and whatnot that were occurring previously, but to require more frequent reporting so that there would be more transparency, and to require those reports to occur simultaneously with the lobbyist reports so that there would be an ability to match up. Okay, this lobbyist says they spent this on this public official. Did this public official actually report it? And now there's very little that can be paid for. And so the little that can be paid for, that is to be reported, are things that your average local public official doesn't take part in. There are trade missions and fact-finding missions, and then there are state and federal government and tribal governments and nonprofit organizations that can provide some expenses. And so what we even heard from the Government Ethics Commission is that there are a lot of zeros on these forms. And specifically from volunteer public officials, the burden of having to fill out this report and being aware that they are personally liable if they don't fill it out raises a great deal of concern. And so this seems to be another area that would be worthwhile really looking at the benefit that you get from the information that's reported on the form, and whether it still needs to be reported quarterly or yearly in light of the burden and the concerns that it raised. So the options, obviously, would be to eliminate the quarterly public official disclosure form entirely. Although you could, there is some information that was previously required to be reported on the SEI, which was moved to the quarterly public officials disclosure form, that you probably would want to move back to the SEI. But comparing those two documents and deciding how to do that. The other, we did receive comment from state agencies and governments about the requirement of reporting expenses paid for by state, local, and federal governments, because we have so many governments, government agencies who pay for expenses for a public official from another government agency. For example, if the Department of Corrections wants to give a number of public officials a tour of a new prison that they just opened, and they pay for your travel out to the prison and to tour it and back, that is all required to be reported on the public official disclosure form. And it creates an administrative burden both for the Department of Correction to provide all those public officials notice of exactly what expenses were paid for them, and then for the public official to in turn report it on the form. And so that's worth consideration, and I don't know if that's that could be taken care of statutorily or administrative. I think those are all options that are available.
And Representative Berger had a question.
Another quick comment. Thank you for mentioning. I was on the Law Commission work group, and this was designed around a bigger system that then subsequently the legislation narrowed everything down, so it doesn't make sense. It was also pretty firmly directed at where lobbyists usually work, which is the legislature or statewide official. And one of the things I would add to your list is to narrow this reporting, this quarterly reporting of lobby, to that group, which was really the target of the, a lobbyist paid for something, did you report it, the transparency piece. And so I would suggest that as another option on there, is to limit the number of people who have to do it to down to the what was the target group, the perceived problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Please go ahead.
Then the third option that we listed there was to maintain the quarterly public officials disclosure form, but to not require its quarterly reporting, but only to require people who have new information to report to file a new report, so that you're not requiring the 000 forms to be filed quarterly. And that would be much easier to do once it's electronic filing.
Speaking of electronic filing, every time I see the acronym QPOD, I just keep thinking this sounds like another Apple product. So maybe we could market it.
So we have a few more recommendations, and one that Senator Devlin asked me to address specifically is the definition of legislative or administrative interest. And I will note that this is a definition that did not change in the reforms, and the issues surrounding the inconsistency in this definition and the breadth of the definition have existed for many years. I think what we found as a team in reviewing the reforms and the implementation and the press coverage is that in reforming the laws, the legislature sort of rose the profile on ethics and shined a spotlight on it, so that a lot of people who weren't really aware of what restrictions applied to them began, all of a sudden bells went off in people's heads. Oh, you mean I can't have lunch with this old college friend who happens to be a top official at Intel? This is a concern. You know, people started to have concerns about things that they hadn't had concerns about, and so it really has shined a spotlight. And I plan to note further down the road that the increased requests for guidance from the Ethics Commission are in large part a result of that, at least equally as much as the changes in the ethics law. So the definition of legislative or administrative interest, this is on page 15, and I outlined where there are two statutory provisions that talk about that definition and refer to it a little differently. And the first is actually in the definition section, which says that the legislative or administrative interest means an economic interest distinct from that of the general public and one or more bills, resolutions, regulations, proposals, or other matters subject to the action or vote of a person acting in the capacity of a public official. So that is very specific to the public official and their duties. Then further down in the gift limits and prohibitions, 244.025, when the use of the term is paired with an expansion of that term, because it says that the legislative or administrative interest, it limits gifts from a source of legislative or administrative interest in any governmental agency in which the public official holds any official position or over which the public official exercises any authority. So, of course, the example that's known to me is the governor. And he, of course, actually not the governor, but say, for instance, his health policy advisor. It would be very obvious that if Providence Hospital, has a legislative or administrative interest, and the health policy advisor certainly has a legislative or administrative interest in the governor. But if someone is, does Providence Hospital have a legislative or administrative interest in the general resource or the natural resources policy advisor on the other end of the office doing completely different policy work? And under the first, under the definition in the definition section, it really would only have to do with the public official's duties and their policy area. And under the gift limitation, it expands it to the entire agency. So in the governor's office, that is pretty much anybody who has an interest in the governor, and it's a great expansion. There's always been this discrepancy in the definition. It's been highlighted because of the reforms. The Ethics Commission has submitted a legislative concept asking that those terms be brought into congruence, and they inform us that they have always interpreted this as it is written in the gift limitations, so the broader definition that it applies to anybody with a legislative or administrative interest in your entire agency or body that you work for. And so that's an issue that you'll need to address.
Can't wait.
The court may do it for us.
Senator Brown, did you have a question?
Having been on the Law Commission, I didn't participate in work groups, but that clearly has been an issue for a long period of time. I assume the other piece that highlighted it is the fact that we further restricted, decreased the value that people could take. So when it was 100 or whatever, it wasn't so much of an issue. Now that it's 50, it certainly also raised the issue substantially.
Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I just wanted to throw in a comment there that we certainly also received a significant number of comments advocating for going the opposite way, which is to line it up narrowly so that there has to be a relationship between the gift giver and the official duties of the duties of the official, not the agency. So it could go either way.
And I mean, this would probably be a good time for me to comment that by soliciting comments the way we did, everybody knows that you tend to get comments from people who are not happy more than you do from people who are happy. We also weren't soliciting comments from the general public, who also have an interest in disclosure and transparency in government. So I think that needs to also underlie our deliberations as we move forward in future hearings.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, did I adequately address your question?
Yes, you did as well as any attorney normally could.
Man, pick that arrow out of you.
It's been an issue for 30 years, Senator Devlin.
Doesn't mean it shouldn't be addressed.
No.
Okay. I would comment that I'll just use an example of one of the extremes of the interpretation of this, and this one I can make public because we've made it public many times. The operations director for the caucus some time ago, not too long ago, had her first child, and she had a baby showers. I haven't been to too many baby showers in decades. But anyway, we had to keep track of every single gift that she received and the value of the gift from anyone inside or outside the building. And I mean, I think that to some people is kind of an extreme. But that was the interpretation that and I would comment that on some of this, you know, we have had to routinely, trying to clarify an issue for a member, had to consult with legislative counsel. And we have a whole battery of attorneys downstairs, several of them that may work on this area. Obviously not every public official out there, particularly a public official in a jurisdiction that only has a contract counsel that they're paying for on an hourly basis, is going to have that ability to consult and to look at what the definition may or may not mean. So I think we have some clear responsibility, since we've recognized this as an ambiguous area of the law for recently and probably for 30 years, to try to address it in any changes we make to this statute.
She's
left out one final area, I think. Did you cover the public official, which was the final?
No, I can cover that next. Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, you did capture a sentiment that came through in a lot of the comments that we received, and that is that a lot of people don't have access to an attorney or for the SEIs to an accountant to help them calculate those things, and that was a comment that we received. One other comment on the definition of legislative or administrative interest that's not included here is the last portion of the definition talks about someone who has a legislative or administrative interest, either currently or could reasonably known to have a legislative or administrative interest. And so that part of the definition is somewhat vague and has, and some people commented that it was difficult to know who could possibly have a legislative or administrative interest. And I know that the City of Portland told us that they pretty much assume any business in the City of Portland could reasonably be known to have a legislative or administrative interest. Therefore, no public official who works for the city, including their 3,500 volunteers, would be able to receive gifts from those people. So that's the other side of it, is that it's It's somewhat vague on the other end as well. So moving on to definition of public official, this again is a definition that's been in existence, I believe, for 30 years. This was not altered by the 2007 reforms, but it is certainly highlighted, as we've discussed, both by the new restrictions and also just by the spotlight that's been placed on ethics. What we saw is that public officials seem to be more concerned about even having an allegation brought against them. The profile's been raised so much that once the bell's been rung, there's a feeling that it can't be unrung, and so they want to be able to comply with the law. The actual definition of public official, primarily what we heard is that it's just very broad and somewhat ambiguous. It's defined as an elected official, appointed official, employee, agent, or otherwise, irrespective of whether the person is compensated for services. And it's really when you get to the agent or otherwise that that the confusion sets in, because many, as we've discussed, many governments rely very heavily on volunteers, and some may be very temporary seasonal employees. So if you have a seasonal employee who's helping clean up the parks, are they then prohibited from, do they then fall under the ethics restrictions? And would that seasonal employee cleaning up the parks actually know who had a legislative or administrative interest in the body that they worked for? So those were some of the concerns that we heard. That was a sort of a bigger area of options than we could get into in any depth. So you'll see that the first option is narrow the description. And the only option that we did identify is just to focus that description more on officials who actually have an administrative decision-making authority or policy-making authority. But admittedly, I will say that when we received comments, we primarily received comments about the SEI. And so now that we're straying into the gift restrictions, we're straying into an area that the team really felt like we did not get to thoroughly review. And so that's why these options are somewhat bare bones.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I held my comments on the earlier ones to the end. So I just had... on the internet listing, did you consider, and my concerns are the internet and the relatives and how they interrelate, which I think is a big concern of a lot of these officials. On the internet, did you ever consider having as an option having a format where the people making the request have to give their names, as they do now for a public records request? I didn't see that on your option list.
Oh, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, I think that I considered that to be just sort of more broadly under option 3, place some type of security measure on the website displaying the information, or make it a secure site. And so that's sort of...
Okay, so that would include some kind of identification so that if something did happen, you'd have some kind of paper trail to help out the investigation of the murder.
I'm not going to touch that one.
Okay. The other question is, and I wasn't on the committee last session, and maybe this was discussed, on the listing of relatives, I could see a case where a relative in another state might be a major property owner within the state and might have indeed a legislative interest, whereas somebody who lives next door to you might work in a totally different industry and their identity is irrelevant to anything that could possibly concern anybody. And I'm just wondering, what possible justification could there be for requiring listing of relatives on anything other than an administrative or legislative interest? I just don't understand what the justification was, because in this section you also have, you know, as an option, listing the justification for listing the relatives. I can't imagine what the justification would be for someone who doesn't have a legislative or administrative interest.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, I did not take part in the Law Commission project, and so I'm going to ask Bill Schradl, who did sort of shadow the Attorney General through the process.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, if I understand the question correctly, I think it's that you're wondering about why you have to list a relative that doesn't have a legislative or administrative interest. Well, I think you touched on it with your example that the relative may be somebody who has, could be, financially benefited by a decision that you make. Now, that may, I mean, it may come within the confines. I don't know how you would determine that in advance. You know, the filing would be, I mean, the decision that you make could be something such as, I'm going to, act on this legislative proposal or administrative proposal before a city council about land use matters, like maybe promulgating administrative rules. Maybe the relative that you could be affecting, maybe they would come within the confines of the legislative or administrative interest if they're a landholder in that area that would be, you know, potentially affected by your decision. I'm just trying to think how you would determine that in advance in terms of when you filed your SEI. You could do something chronologically that would, and I think some of the commenters came at it from, we already have in place conflicts of interest requirements that if I have a decision before me that I, you know, have to make a decision on that is going to have some effect, and I know that it could have an effect upon somebody who, you know, is related to me, that I have to declare that conflict of interest. So you can get at it that way. I think a couple of rationales were there with respect to relatives. And one of them Kelly touched upon earlier, and that was that for people who are interested in giving things, it may be helpful for them to have a resource that they can look to find out whether this is a person to whom I can give a gift or not. And then also the understanding that public officials should go through that requirement in advance to figure out when they do have something that comes before them, whether I need to make, you know, declare a conflict of interest or not. So those are two purposes behind
Madam
it.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up. If you're serious about that and really wanting to call out people who might have a financial gain without a legislative or administrative interest, then shouldn't we indeed be requiring all legislators, all relatives, to fill out SEI forms so that the public can determine whether they have an interest or not? Yeah.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, yes, I think you can, as a matter of logic with many of these, draw the lines out very far. I think the challenge that exists in this, I think Representative Esquivel's question earlier touches upon this too. There are, at some point, there have to be lines drawn that you determine are the most appropriate lines that will capture the right balance of capturing those interests that you are concerned about without being overly broad. And in all of these circumstances, wherever you draw a line, there are going to be circumstances that fall inside that probably are inappropriate and are outside of that you should have captured. That's the real challenge with many of these things, because, yes, you could follow that out, that maybe we should require all relatives to file SEIs as well. But
for the record, Madam Chair, I am not advocating this. I don't want any hate mail, and I don't want my relatives to have any
good,
hate mail either.
Good save, Senator Burdick. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would have to say, after I heard it here the second time, I'd heard it before on the radio in a report, that justification that somehow having a complete list of all relatives would be helpful to those people potentially making gifts so that they could account for it, so that they didn't violate the law, was to me like sort of the most bogus case for a broad governmental requirement that I have ever heard. That would imply to me that an interest that out there is going to maintain a master list of all the relatives that are listed on this, and that every time that they do anything, they're going to consult this list. Now, I actually feel much better about the issue in terms of disclosure of an administrative or legislative interest, because in the example of the relative that lives in New Jersey but owns substantial holdings within this city, if I'm a city councilor, I know that. So if I make a decision and I know that they're impacted by that decision. I think that's a much more clear, much more transparent disclosure to the public than simply disclosing that I have a relative in New Jersey. And I just wanted to put that on the record.
Yeah. Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Devlin, if I might respond. Yes, I think, I mean, a number of these things, I think, have historically been there as proxies for trying to get at the interest that you're concerned about. And if and when you can define the interest in a way that is both clear, because I think one of the challenges here is to have clear rules so people know what to follow, but to have it be clear and then capture the right set of interests, yes. If you need to use proxies, then you need to use proxies, and that's I think, the challenge.
Quick follow-up.
Yes, please.
One of the areas of the definition that is always a hard area, particularly for elected officials, is an interest that's distinct from the public.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe either you or Dexter or anyone wants to comment. Maybe for political reasons, not for legal reasons, when we referred Measure 49 out to the public, we had literally every individual on the floor that owned any natural resource property or had a potential Measure 39 claim disclose that. I don't know if that would actually be required under the law, because I think they'd still be a broad public issue. Secondarily, I think, let me use an example that's even more specific. If I'm a dentist, which I'm not, and we extend benefits further under the Oregon Health Plan for individuals, I'm not sure that that would be something that would have to be disclosed, because that would be a broader public interest than I think a direct. But I think this is the kind of ambiguity that makes it difficult for public officials to be able to comply with the law. And the more we can do to diminish the ambiguity, I think the better off. And I did want you to comment, though, on the, see what your comment is relative to an interest distinct from the general public. I think that's the terminology I'm trying to remember. It's used in the definition.
And I believe it's an economic interest, is it not?
Yeah.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin. You're correct. It is a difficult line to draw, and there isn't an easy solution. The distinction, I think I agree with your example, at least the dentist example, that it isn't, and I think that, follow up other members of the team, but I think that what makes that clearly an example of where you don't have an interest that is different from the public is that the public includes dentists, and you made the decision to become a dentist prior to becoming a public official. Though, I mean, I can see facts where just the opposite would be the case, but that seems to me makes it where that your economic interest is not different than that of the public. Any thoughts?
Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Devlin. I think the rubric that has been used historically there has been whether you're in a large, you know, it affects a large enough class that it isn't viewed as an individualized interest that you need to be concerned about. Again, there are going to be line drawing issues there as well. And the driver behind most of the concerns here is to get at the issue of either the public official benefiting him or herself, or benefiting a person to whom they have a close relationship, whether that be, and part of the idea of getting relatives here through the law commission process was to bring a standardized definition of relative throughout the entire scope of the ethics law so that there was one definition that applied as well. And that played into it a little bit as well, because there, I think, had always been a requirement that you had to list a spouse, for example, on your SEI. The idea being that a single definition applicable across all of the ethics laws would be clearer and cleaner to administer both from the Ethics Commission side of things, but also from the public official side of things, was also a driver that was back there. Those are the principles that I think need to drive the decisions, and how you get at them, whether it is by explicit, precise definitions within the statute, is one way, or giving broader kind of purpose in the statute and then having that play out on the edges. I think either way, even if with explicit statutory definitions, then I think the concern that you need to be wondering about is how you get the right scope to get at the purposes. It's kind of a chicken or egg problem. You can specify it and you will be missing some people on both sides. You'd be overly inclusive and then missing some. Or you can be a general statutory standard, and then it's going to play out in the individual circumstances whether you come within that or not, neither of which are perfectly satisfactory.
Thank you. And, yes, Representative Esquivel.
One thing about the individuals from out of state or whatever that own property within the municipality that you're on a city council. First of all, you have to disclose that. Second of all, you have to recuse yourself, because if that's blood relative and or you, let's say, a father-in-law, mother-in-law, or whatever, you shouldn't be participating. Matter of fact, we went to the point in Medford where I was on the city council, and on all subdivisions, I had to talk about a conflict of interest, a potential conflict of interest, because I am a realtor. Consequently, if you bring in a subdivision, you have a potential economic gain by that, because I may not represent the individual that has the subdivision, but I may represent the buyer. So therefore, the attorney said I needed to do that. And I did that religiously every time we had a subdivision come in the city limits of, that was approved within the city limits of Medford. Having said that, let's try to go back and think of the KISS system. We need to simplify this. We could go on and go on and go on. And folks, you're either born with ethics or you don't have them.
Thank you for your comment. Okay, did that complete your presentation?
Actually, Chair Rosenbaum, there were two additional options that I wanted to cover just briefly, and the conversation that we were having with Senator Devlin, I think, were a great prelude to the increased resources for the Government Ethics Commission. And we included this because the team, in our review of all of the materials and our interviews of reading of all the comments, the one sort of overwhelming thing that we found was that in light of the reforms and the raising of the profile and the shining of the spotlight on ethics, there is a great deal of anxiety among public officials about compliance with ethics laws. And so what they are doing is they're turning to the Ethics Commission for guidance, and they really want certainty, and the Ethics Commission is trying its hardest to provide that. At the same time that the legislature reformed the ethics laws, you also recall that you ratcheted up the penalties, which also contributes to the increased anxiety. And so the Ethics Commission informs us that they're spending, you know, an inordinate amount of time providing this advice. And some of it is just telephone staff advice. Some of it is written staff advice. And then obviously they can give out formal opinions, which actually have a binding effect. But there is a great need for certainty among public officials, and the Government Ethics Commission right now doesn't have the resources to provide that. And I understand that they will be coming before the Emergency Board and requesting some increased funding for legal advice, because they have been draining their budget for legal resources, trying to respond to these and some other particular legal issues that have arisen as a result of the of the reforms. And so that's something that's worth looking at. And I want to emphasize that that's not entirely a result of the 2007 reforms. That's a result of just the it's also a result of us shining a light on ethics reforms and the fact that some public officials have been held accountable in the paper. And so that has increased the anxiety about ethics in general. And the last option that we presented is is more administrative, and that is providing some assistance for small agency implementation of new programs. And one thing, as we went into this, we were impressed by the expanse of the ethics reform project and just how big this was. And this is a small agency. It started at 3 people, and in the period of 6 months, it grew to 6 people. It's still only 6 people. And it's just it's a huge program. All public officials are having a hard time wrapping their arms around it, and this was a very small agency that really didn't have any guidance. And so one of the things that we came up with were these options of having some sort of mentoring program or a process by which the Department of Administrative Services could provide assistance to small agencies who are implementing a large program such as this. One of the tensions that that arise for small agencies is they feel very responsible to be fiscally conservative and fiscally responsible with the budget that they're given, and they don't want to appear to be coming to the e-board and asking for more resources. And then you put the overlay on that of this is the Government Ethics Commission. So it was a hard thing even for the governor's office, who normally for an executive branch agency would reach out and provide some assistance to that agency, because this is a regulatory body that's regulating us all. It was hard for anybody to reach in and give some assistance. And so we presented as an option that either the Department of Administrative Services or the legislature come up with some sort of mentoring program that would provide some resources for any small agency in implementing such a large program. And what I would close with is it's captured in the conclusion of our report, and that is that, again, the team spent a lot of time reviewing the reforms, and this was just a huge, complex reform effort that the legislature undertook, and these were major steps in enhancing public confidence in their government, and I that is sort of the goal that we were all seeking. But in light of how expansive it is, and in light of how many public officials it applies to, it's sort of expected that there will be some minor adjustments that need to be considered. And so we felt that the options that were available were pretty. Would give you some flexibility, and that the legislature should feel open to those options in the future in light of how big of an area of law this is.
Well, thank you for your presentation. I want to thank you, too, personally, because I think that you were asked to do a pretty Herculean task in a very short time to try to outline where the pressure points are and what the original intent of what was certainly a sweeping overhaul, and I think most people felt was overdue, and so it wasn't an easy task, and I think that you've completed it admirably. And I believe Representative Berger and then Senator Devlin had questions.
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair. When you discussed penalties and the increase in penalties, is it not true that also contained in the law commission that became law was an opt-out for the commission doesn't have to, which was a huge improvement, because in the past, if they found somebody violated, they had to fine, and we gave them the option to censure instead of fine, which helps a lot in small cases.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, absolutely. And that option is provided to the Government Ethics Commission. I think what we found in reviewing the comments was that the anxiety of public officials wasn't really appeased by knowing that option was there.
They knew the other one.
One, the allegation in and of itself, specifically if it's reported in a newspaper, is damaging enough that they want to avoid it. And two, I don't think that we didn't sense that there was enough confidence of public officials that the Government Ethics Commission was going to actually follow that route. But I think primarily it has to do with just allegations. Nobody really wants to run afoul of the ethics laws, and so they want to know how not to. And they'd rather not reach the point where they need to be told by the Ethics Commission.
Follow up. Yeah, as someone who worked on the work group and who was very critical of the way the final legislation sort of became law, the additions and changes that I didn't think were good, some of which
I've proven right or wrong, and some of which I was dead wrong about. I just want to put on the record here, if you don't mind, at this point, that a lot of this legislation was a huge improvement over what we had. We aren't talking about those things. We're only talking about the huge problems that also came forward, and I guess I want to put on the record, because this penalties is one of them, there were huge improvements to our ethics laws and how they fit together in the Law Commission report and in the package of Senate Bill 10 and the whole series of things. But we did also create, I think, some significant problems, and I think it is our charge to deal with the problem areas, but let's not forget all the good stuff.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Senator Devlin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to put on the record on behalf of the Senate Committee a great deal of thanks for your hard work on this issue, and I would assume your report and all your documentation will become part of the record of this committee's deliberations on SB 10. I did want to comment, too, that I didn't mean to make a snide mark about attorneys, but but with three attorneys before me, I couldn't resist. And also, I did want to comment on Ms. Taylor, who did not get an opportunity to speak, who I believe has probably contributed greatly to this task, but she's on the wrong side of the dais. But I just wanted to put that on the record also. I would hope, even though you've done a lot of hard work and it's very appreciated, that you would remain a resource to both committees in their deliberations, particularly during the interim, because we're going to have some difficult choices to make. And I think that the amount of time that you've been able to spend looking at these issues, the help that you'll be able to give the committee will be invaluable.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your testimony and for your work.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Farioli.
As I'm supposed to be making what sound like wrap-up statements, I'd like to add some to the record, if I might.
Sure, and they're only wrap-up for this portion, because coming immediately on the heels of this will be the Ethics Commission's testimony. So
now I'll wait until I've heard from the Ethics Commission.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
And I noticed that Representative Witt is sitting in the audience, and I'm sure he realizes that we would more than welcome him to be joining us at the dais. Okay, would the Ethics Commission please come forward? Good morning, and
good morning.
Thank you for listening, and we're looking forward to your testimony. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. To my left here is Judy Stigler. She is the chair of the commission, so she'll be happy to field all the questions you folks have.
As I dive under the table. Not true.
I had provided the committee with a memo dated today from the commission, and I just wanted to point out a few things. I mean, you've heard a lot from the ethics reform team, and I think the reform team has covered a lot of the areas. When I reviewed the report, there was just a few points that I wanted to make in addition to what you've already heard from the team. The first point is I included examples here, is the commission and Dexter had also testified to this, that in mid-January the commission had actually contacted these contacts for the local jurisdictions out there, all the jurisdictions in the state. And these contacts, they are the ones that actually provide the commission with the list of public officials that are required to file the Statement of Economic Interest. At that time, back in January, we did provide them not only with a letter asking for this, and I actually gave a couple examples, because we sent a letter out to new jurisdictions that hadn't filed in the past. I think it was testified to earlier, it was 81 cities, actually 97 cities and 6 counties. So there's 2 separate letters in here, and I labeled one, I believe, as new jurisdictions, and the other one is regular jurisdictions. So I hope I didn't offend anybody by those comments. But anyway, inside of that letter was also a sample of the Statement of Economic Interest with instructions. So the additional requirements required on the Statement of Economic Interest was provided to the jurisdictions back in January, and I just thought that was an important point to make. Secondly, in prior years, the statement of economic interest was sent out in mid-March, and the agency recognizes the delay in sending this out to the beginning of April, and that delay did cause some anxiety by public officials, and we apologize for that. I think it was testified or it was pointed out by the reform team that just trying to get these additional cities and counties to get us these names took a little bit more effort than happened in the past. There was also another bill that passed, I believe it was Senate Bill 615, that required public hospitals to also have their board members file SEIs, and that was another group that hasn't been discussed here today that we also needed to get those members' names. So, again, we apologize for the delay, and we recognize that the problems that caused. It had been talked about that the agency has submitted a legislative concept to try to unify this idea of legislative administrative interest, and our concept does focus on the person's interest in the agency or the government body that they work for, and we recognize that you can look at it two ways. You either look at it in the person or you can look at it in the agency. The Ethics Commission has always taken that broader interpretation, and so this legislative concept is around that broader interpretation. But we submitted that back in April, and we recognize the inconsistencies in the statutes, and we had actually come forward to try to correct those. The agency has requested by the e-board an administrative position to help with the additional paperwork, and I've outlined some numbers here, and they're fairly significant. In the past statement of economic interest, we received about 4,200 forms. This year, it was testified earlier, there was 5,509 forms that came in, but just so I could do the math easy, I just rounded it off. I hope that's all right with the committee, but so we rose up from 4,200 to 5,500, which doesn't seem significant, but when you add the quarterly reports in there, now we're actually filing 5,500 times, five times a year, so we have a total increase of about 23,300 reports. So it was a very significant increase. At the same time, the lobbyist reports, which hasn't been part of this discussion so far, in legislative years, lobbyists were required to file three times a year, in non-legislative years, twice a year. And the entities or the employers, clients that they worked for, were required to file once a year. Under the ethics reforms, they are all now required to file quarterly, including the entities. So this also has increased in non-legislative years, has increased the number of filings by 5,400. We have approximately 900 lobbyists and about 900 employers, clients of lobbyists out there. And in legislative years, there's about 4,500 additional reports. So this additional paperwork that has come in the office essentially has overwhelmed us, and so we have asked for an additional position. I also included some information back here. There's been some talk about the reason why we asked for information from local jurisdictions, and I just wanted to point out that the agency's workload on the compliance side traditionally has historically has been about 31% of our complaints come from cities, about 11% from counties. So we're talking about the cities and counties that were added here. Now, I'm not saying they came from those specific ones that were added, but I'm saying local jurisdictions of cities and counties. So about 42% of the complaint process or the complaints received by the agency since 2001 have come from cities and counties. And I think there's actually a chart back here that outlines that, and I think there's some pretty telling numbers there. I think the ethics reform team actually outlined the hiring of the new people. I think they did a very good job of doing that. I just outlined in here the reasons why those were staggered, that they didn't all come on July 1st. The other thing that the agency had to do, and I don't think it was mentioned earlier, was the agency had to move. We were actually in a place that would only fit three. So even though we only increased to six, we couldn't fit in the place that we were at. So there was also a move in there, and that took place on September 1st of 2007. Other information I'd like to share with the committee, just real briefly. Out of these Statement of Economic Interest filers, the agency sent back 1,069 letters, and that was requesting clarification or additional information to be turned on the form. The total number of resignations as of June 16th, it's just a little bit different number than the reform team had given you, just a little more updated number, is 239. I thought it was very interesting. We broke down that 239, and 146 of those resignations did come from the new cities and counties that were required to file, 61%. But 39% came from jurisdictions that had filed in the past. 47, I think the ethics reform team had 38 at their report, but as of the 16th, 47 Statement of Economic Interest filers have informed the agency that they will refuse to complete the required information on the form. And there was some question about penalty on these forms earlier to the team, and the agency has not penalized anybody at this time. These 47, if the commission, if they do come before the commission, they would come before the commission on an own motion, and it would basically be an incomplete form. It would be they'd file the form timely, but it's just not the information on there isn't complete. Similar to what we've seen in prior instances on Statement of Economic Interest complaints that have come to the agency, the people that simply have not filed, there was also a question about that. Is there a grace period that we give? And there is a grace period built into the statute of 15 days. But as of today, we have not penalized anybody for late filing. I want to point that out. So, yes, there was a letter sent out, and that letter did say there was a potential for penalty, but no penalties have been given to those folks as of yet. The reform team touched briefly about the additional attorney general costs. One issue that come to the agency is it's in the past 2 months. The attorney generals had to address some general orders that were filed by some presiding judges in the state of Oregon, trying to exempt them from the release of members of household and relatives. And the agency has expended about $17,000 just on that one issue over the past couple months. Now, this is an agency that has roughly $64,000 of biennial attorney general costs. This is a significant amount of a significant issue for us. And lastly, I'd like to point out that the agency, since November of 2007, has performed 49 trainings for a total of 110 hours. These trainings have concentrated on changes to the ethics laws made during the 2007 session. One of these trainings, I just want to point out specifically because a lot of this issues kind of arose from the LeGrand, Elgin area, but Tammy Hedrick, our trainer, was actually in there on March 25th. We actually sent her over there to specifically talk to those groups. They held a training session in LeGrand on the 25th of March to address their concerns. So we were out training to these folks and spent a lot of resource doing that. Earlier there was some questions, I believe, by Senator Farioli on the phone on questions that the staff has received, and it's true the ethics reform team has testified that the staff has spent a significant amount of time in answering specific people's questions to whether they can or cannot do something or how they set up an event so that they're within compliance of the ethics laws. And to this date, it's well over 200 in that file. And yes, the agency is keeping that on file. We have asked people to submit those by email, and we have actually, because if you remember in the ethics reform, there was a third level of advice advice that was given called staff advice, as opposed to a more formalized staff opinion and, of course, the most formal advisory opinion that the commission actually votes on and adopts, and that provides safe harbor to the people or to anybody that actually operates inside of that advisory opinion. But the staff advice, we are keeping a file of that staff advice at the office, and currently we are updating our website, and we are trying to get that information out. I understand, you know, it would always be helpful a few months back, but as you can see from what the Ethics Reform team has said and what I have tried to testify to here, we are really trying to get this done as quickly as we can. And I don't have, excuse myself for a moment. I actually called the staff. I was not aware of anyone that had not been addressed, asking for advice and not been given an answer. And so I had contacted staff, and they were not aware of anybody. So if somebody has not got advice from the Ethics Commission, then I would invite them to contact me directly, because I would really like to know about that. And if that advice is still pertinent to this day, we will get that to them right away. And I'm sorry, that's all I have.
Yes, and Senator Devlin.
Yeah, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just some very quick questions, because I do think there's going to be a need for the committee to, or at least members of the committee, to spend more time with Ethics Commission staff and members of the Ethics Commission. I have actually been in your offices previous occasions when all the forms were being received, which is not a pretty picture. I do find it actually interesting that you have the resources to at least review the forms and to see if they are filled out, because I think, given the resources that you have, that's a daunting task. But the question I had more directly is, to your knowledge, how often is the receipt of a form and information on that form led to an investigation by the Ethics Commission versus, I believe most of your investigations come from complaints coming in, not on information disclosed in the form. The form may come forward once a case has been put forward, quite honestly, because I think that will become part of the record to see if something had been disclosed or not disclosed. But how often have you seen a case that has been initiated by the receipt of the form?
Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Devlin, the actual cases that we see are not, I guess I need to back up just a second. The reason for the form is that the public is able to review that form and see where certain public officials' interests lie.
Right.
And so they have a suspicion, somebody in the public has a suspicion that somebody's made a decision that may be a conflict. And so they ask for that information from us. Now, if your question is, has the agency just generated a complaint because of what we have seen from the form, then that I do not know that that has happened in the past. The 47 that I mentioned here are forms that we got that the public official put on the form, basically informed us explicitly that they were going to that they had information that should be on the form, but they are refusing to put that information. And 99% of those is around the issue of relatives. They have told us that they have had relatives, but they are going to refuse to give that to us. And so the commissioners at one point, will actually need to look at those filers and make a determination. Now, that determination could be, Representative Berger had pointed out, that the commission was given some more leeway as far as how we actually sanction someone. But, you know, I don't know that at this point. At this point, we do have 47 there, and the reason there is because essentially people have made the case that they have the information, but they're not giving it to the agency.
And Chair Devlin, Chair Rosenbaum, just to clarify further,
can you please identify yourself for the record?
I'm Judy Stigler, Chair of the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. There have been occasions when
SEI filers in the past where letters have gone out. They haven't filed them in a timely manner. Letters have gone out to remind them that they're delinquent in getting those forms back, and we don't get any response still. And then there is action taken with respect to that. That has happened in the past.
Right, for non-filers.
For people who have not filed who should be filing. But that's after, again, the grace period, a reminder letter, and there is a penalty that is provided by statute, sort of a per-day kind of penalty that accrues. And they're told about that when the letter goes out telling them that the deadline's come and gone, they haven't filed, that kind of thing. That's happened in the past. And what Mr. Burson is referring to with this group of 47, and which is, at least during my tenure, not happened in the past, where people have absolutely refused to provide information on form. This is another sort of subset of those filers.
Follow up. I understand that the issue here is transparency, and I think that's the benefit of the form. I just wanted to create a more common understanding that you don't have the resources to actually review all cases, and you are still, like in most cases in law, you are depending upon the voluntary compliance of individuals to comply with the law. The second question I had was in terms of, if you could comment a little bit about the form itself, what steps you took to redesign the form, who you consulted in that. I do know the internal sort of issues you have in terms of, see, as an individual person who's filled them out, I would just love to have a copy that was a fill-in Word file that I could send back to you. Or I would love to be able to do it online or that. But I understand your issue about controlling who submits them, but I think there's probably ways to address that. But what the Commission's discussion has been relative to making this maybe not a publicly searchable database, but at least the ability to file electronically, which is, I know for some people don't always have that capability, but for a whole lot of people would make the process a lot easier.
Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Devlin, as far as the design of the current form, the 2008 form, the agency designs that, and we do consult with our legal counsel on that to make sure that it, you know, it conforms with all the requirements of statute. Now, as far as the new forms that are out there, that process is underway right now. We have a consultant working on the filing project, the electronic filing project. And currently right now, they are looking at the current process, that one that you illustrated the beauty of with all the forms out there. In other words, our as-is process compared to what we would like to be, and then doing a gap analysis on that. So we are actually in the midst of trying to design this electronic reporting system. And any comments anybody would like to make on that, I would welcome those at this time, because we're just in the beginning stages of saying this is what we'd like it to look like. I mean, some of the things that we've talked about is at each and every step of the way that there's some type of drop-down instructions that happen, that there's, you know, these are just some of the ideas that are popping up. But right now it's basically just this conversing with the consultant and what we're doing back and forth trying to come up with a form. But I would welcome any comments.
Chair Devlin and Chair Rosenbaum, just as further clarification on that, one of the instructions that the Commission has given to staff is that we want this to be a user-friendly process, first and foremost. And secondly, we are cognizant that just because it's electronic doesn't mean it's not subject to the public records laws. It's still subject to the public records laws, and ergo you get into the kinds of things that you've been talking about here today. And I think it was mentioned earlier that there were some concerns about certain parts of that electronic form being not available for you know, public disclosure or being exempted. Obviously, that's going to create more complexity in putting together any kind of electronic system. But we want it to be user-friendly. We also want it to meet all requirements of security, too, but within the context that it is a public record, because that's what the paper record is right now. It's open to, you know, upon request to disclosure.
And I just want to make, well, going back to this gathering of the public officials that are required to file, there has been talk in this electronic process of simplifying that process and getting some of the burden away from the agency and making it easier for people to keep those lists updated instead of just on a yearly basis. If somebody changes out a city council member in any city, that they could simply go in and change their database. And so right now it's a once-a-year process, and you can see from the report, we started that process in mid-January, and the process really didn't end until April 1st when the forms were sent out. So there has been talk in this process of making that much easier, too.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, I've got you, Senator Farioli.
This,
is it your intention to come back after the lunch hour to continue through?
It's my intention to complete this portion of the agenda by 1:30 and then break for lunch, and then just the House committee would be coming back after that.
Tough it out.
Conflict from 12 till 1. And if it would be possible for me just to make a couple statements and then ring off.
Senator Burdick has the floor at the moment. I'll defer to her.
I'll yield to Senator Farioli.
Thank you. Please go ahead, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you, Senator Burdick. Just two things. We have received here correspondence directly from elected public officials who have not had their questions responded to, either timely or at all. So I think that offline, I'd like to get my staff together with Mr. Burson's staff and find out why there's that inconsistency. I'm sure it's just a matter of understanding or semantics or timing, but we forwarded emails that we received from elected officials that have not had their questions answered to every member of the legislature. So there, you know, we do have a real question about whether or not those issues are being addressed. They're being addressed timely, and I'm very gratified to hear that there is such a log that we discussed earlier of advices that have gone out to people, because I think that's going to be the body of knowledge that we're going to rely on here. Madam Chairman, secondly, in regard to Senate Bill 10, there is much good, but we have engaged in overkill. I'm reminded a great deal about the crosswalk legislation that we were all initially so proud of.
Excuse me, Senator Farioli? I take back my yield.
The crosswalk legislation, you have to remember that I was the one who put that legislation to the test.
Clearly, figuratively.
Voice of experience.
But the point I guess I'm trying to make here is that I think we really need to take a good, hard look and be disposed about what it is that we already have on the books, conflict of interest laws, and then use the revisitation of Section 10 to enhance and clarify what we already have in place in the conflict of interest laws. And, you know, I think we're starting to learn that we may have gone too far afield in one area, and that's the listing of relatives and in-laws, and you know, not even blood relatives. We're going like two iterations outside the immediate family. I think the conflict of interest laws, if we really look at them, are sufficient to protect in those cases. And I would not want to be in a situation where all we're doing is causing over-reporting of a bunch of information so that somebody later can play gotcha because there was a failure to report as voluminously as somebody thinks it's required, and that results in a complaint, or that if after the statutes that are on the books have already worked the way they're supposed to, somebody goes back and files a complaint. That's just gotcha politics, and I don't think we need to do that again. I don't think that serves the public interest. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to our exploration of what's already on the books, and possibly an acknowledgement that maybe we, in the first iteration, swung a little bit wide, and if we could bring the focus back in. At the end of the day, I want to be able to go to folks in all the jurisdictions, urban and rural, and say, transparency is greater, ease of filing is greater. We're not subjecting elected public officials to those that just get their jollies from internet searching and trying to manufacture conflict. And at the end of the day, we're helping Mr. Burson and the commission in their role by clarification and simplification. So, you know, I think there's a lot to do. And Madam Chair, thank you for your indulgence. And Senator Burdick, thank you for your view.
Thank you for your comments, Senator Farioli. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question has to do with this whole discussion of relatives kind of reminds me of the sex offender registry, which is many tens of thousands of people on the sex offender registry, everything from a 19-year-old who had non-forcible sex with his 15-year-old girlfriend to somebody who rapes a 2-year-old. They're all there on the sex offender registry. And that's what kind of what this relative thing reminds me of. My question to you is, what do you you're the closest thing we have to on the ground with really trying to improve the ethical climate in public life in Oregon. What do you think would be most valuable to you as the people who are kind of on the ground with the ethics reform and to the public? Is it to list, for example, on my ethics report, I listed 10 relatives. You have, and if I'm typical, you have 5,500 reports. So here you have 55,000 relatives showing up on forms, give or take, if I'm typical, and I may not be. In fact, I'm not married because I imagine many of them have many more who have in-laws to deal with. My question to you, is it better to have 55,000 relatives out there of all descriptions without any kind of basis for why they're on there? In other words, you don't even know where they live, really. All you have is their names, and you don't have their occupation. You don't have, you know, what their financial interest is. Would it be better to have it that way in terms of actually being useful to your to you and the public, or would it be better to have the public official list those few? In my case, it would be at most one with a legislative or administrative interest.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, yeah, that's a great question, and that's, I think, the team, and I think that the people that drew up the legislation, I think that's what they struggled with, is, you know, where do you draw that line? Your question to me about listing relatives with the legislative administrative interest, I would go back to Senator Devlin's comments earlier about trying to shore up the definition of legislative administrative interest. So me, I'm just looking at it as an agency standpoint, I'm able to inform the folks that are required to file this what it means so that they understand that it's just the one relative, not the 10 that you have.
And my question assumed that that would be dealt with.
Okay. So, you know, administratively, you know, that would be easier on the agency is to list, you know, maybe a more focused effort might be administratively easier. But the real question is, and I think you'll find this out later in further hearings, what I've heard from the schedule, is you know, I would be interested in knowing from the public, you know, what's important to them. Is it important for them to list all the relatives, or is it important to them just to list the relatives that have that interest that person holds? That would be interesting to me. What was interesting to me in this process was we heard a lot of comments from people, and I want to expand relative to also talk about member of household, because I don't think we've actually talked about that today. I think member of household was kind of lumped into that because there were some relatives that were in there too, but I think those two were the big sticking points with a lot of public officials that filed with us. But, you know, we heard a lot of comments from public officials and a lot of clarity and a lot of talk from them, but the agency itself, and maybe people don't want to call us, but I still haven't got a discussion from the public, and that surprised me. I thought when cities lost planning commissions that somebody from the public would call my office and say, "What did you do to my planning commission?" But we haven't received that, so I'm very interested in knowing who, what the public thinks about narrowing that focus, and you know, frankly, I think maybe their answer is more important than my answer administratively, but it would be easier for me as an agency.
Well, if I can follow that up, if regardless of whether it's narrow or broad, do you think that to be useful to help the public judge, you know, whether a relative is a problem or not, ethically speaking, do you think it would be appropriate to require more information about the relatives? For example, their occupation, where they get their funds, et cetera, where they live?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, I think there is value in the names of the relatives. People in the past, there are the conflict of interest statutes that are out there, and all public officials are required to follow those. What this form did, or what by listing these relatives, it made it easier for the public to know, are you making decisions that may benefit a relative? I mean, it's easy to find decisions that may benefit me personally as a public official, but it's more difficult for the public to know if I make a decision, is that my brother-in-law or is that my sister-in-law or is it some relative that I'm giving that benefit to? So in that aspect, I think the form does make it easier for the public to kind of find those conflicts that are out there. The form's too new for me to testify that the public has used it. So I can't really testify to that.
If I just one more follow-up, but what value could it have? I mean, you list, you know, Joe Smith as a relative. You don't have to say what kind of relative. You don't have to say where they are. And you don't have to say what they do or where they get their money or, you know, how old they are or anything else. How could that be of value?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, I apologize. I live in this small world. It's myself, and I have this strange last name, so I forget about the Smiths and Jones and Williams and the other common names out there. And that is a concern. I think that, you know, if you have a common name, how much value is there in there? I said there was some value. I don't know how valuable it is, but I apologize for kind of answering the question in my own sense. I think my relatives was valuable to the public out there. I think they'll be able to find out who those are.
Thank you. Representative Berger?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You talked about your work so far, Mr. Bersons and Ms. Stegler. Thank you for coming. But I have a feeling that there's another tidal wave coming, and that is we all who, particularly I became very aware of it when I was working on the Law Commission, we're coming into an election season. And Senator Farioli sort of alluded to it. What happens is the complaint-driven process starts with people filing a complaint for whatever reason, and it immediately becomes a political issue. And I'm very concerned about these 47 people who didn't complete it or complained about it, and whether you are about to be faced with a tidal wave of complaints, whether they are valid or not, is not the issue. It's that tidal wave that I see coming, and its impact on this agency. Want to talk about that?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, I agree with you. I mean, the agency is always faced with that uncertainty because, you know, we really don't have any control over complaints that come in or, you know, workload type issues. We just don't have a lot of control. Like this advice that was brought up, I mean, I said that files well over 200 pieces of advice. We don't have any control on who calls the agency and needs something at that time. So workload is an issue. In fact, you know, I haven't talked about it, but, you know, the agency needs to set up some procedures. I mean, one of the procedures we need to set up was the agency was given the ability or entities were given the ability to come to the agency with policies and have the commission approve those policies. And we've received one of those. It was new. We really don't have a great procedure for it at this point. Unfortunately, somebody's a victim of that, and we're trying to get through that as best we can with all the other things happening. So you're right. I mean, workload is a huge issue for me, and I am looking at that. But, you know, we hopefully we'll start heading some of this off with getting people more and more trained.
Follow on.
So is your agency, I mean, I can see this specific filing issue as one that where you are going to have a raft of complaints over, particularly at the local government level. Somebody doesn't like somebody, they request it, and then they say, oh, you forgot a relative, and I'm filing a complaint. Have you, as an agency, because you have not yet decided what you're going to do about late filings, have you thought about what you're going to do when you start getting complaints on these? And I'm not asking for what your answer is. Have you, I mean, how are you going to address this? Because it's coming your way.
Yeah, Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, first of all, it's not the late filings that were held up on. It's the folks that refused to file that were a little bit held up on. The late folks that filed, it's kind of statutorily set out what we're going to do there. So that's not a concern. But, yes, the agency is talking about that. We're talking about it with the commission, and we're talking about it amongst ourselves with my investigators to find out, you know, how are we going to tackle this workload issue that, and we predicted that that's going to come about.
Yes, please go ahead.
Just to further expand on that, I mean, 47 sounds like a small number, but that's potentially 47 own motion complaints that we have to process.
Exactly.
That's a lot of complaints. So we're very cognizant of, you know, that impact, because as Mr. Burson alluded to, workload we don't have a lot of control over. It's sort of like changing tires on the bus as it's going down the road, and you know, you don't want the bus to go off the road as much as possible. So we're trying to keep track of all of that and keep up with as much of that as possible in a timely manner.
One more.
I know.
Yeah, and on top of those 47, you've also got this renewed interest in what's a gift and what's a filing, and you are going to face a tidal wave in the election of inquiries and possible, you know, complaints that, I mean, I just foresee a tidal wave of this coming your way because of this legislation and the ambiguities in the law and the new awareness. I'll shut up.
New awareness. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burson, to follow up on the electronic filing issue, I know you've got a lot that you're working with the agency. You mentioned having a consultant as part of this process, but what timeline are you working on? When will we be able to have electronic filing of these forms?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, the statute calls for January 10th, and my goal is to before then so that we can get up and running and we can test it. The consultant should be through with their work on September 1st, and then they will we'll be creating an RFP from that work. So an RFP will come out of that work, I should say, and we'll be putting out the bid. According to the consultant that I'm working with, we are well within time, and they're actually looking at the system as being fairly straightforward. It's not, so far they haven't seen any kind of big issues that's going to hold this up. One of the issues that they had was around the requirement of a signature on the statement of economic interest, but there's a statute out there, we just had to check with DOJ, but there's a statute out there that allows for that. If it's in Department of Revenue, your tax return, there's lots of things that get an electronic signature, but that was the only holdup that they have seen so far in the work they've done. So, you know, I'm looking at mid-year to September of 09 to get this system up and let us test that. Obviously, we don't want to just have it up on January 1st and then find the bug. So, but statutorily, it's supposed to come up in January of 10, and so those reports that are due January 15th, the quarterly reports on January 15th should be electronic.
Thank you very much.
Senator Brown.
Thanks. Just a quick question, and thanks, Ron and Judy, for all your hard work. I talked with an elected official who happens to be in a domestic partnership relationship, and he had called to find out whether he needed to declare his domestic partner's relatives, and he was told no. And I am really concerned, given that we passed House Bill 2007 requiring registered domestic partnerships to be treated like marriage. So I'm concerned that he got that answer from the Ethics Commission.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Brown, you know, I don't want to get into a law discussion with when I'm surrounded by people that are more have more expertise than myself. But the definition of relative, the domestic partner's relatives would not meet those definition of relative. In other words, and so I mean, in the statute, it actually did not include that, because is, and I say this is just what I was been told, is an example is, what do I say, is the sister-in-law of the domestic partner.
Madam Chair, I don't want to get into a discussion about it, but I think you need to check with the lawyers because that was clearly the intent with the passage of House Bill 2007, and I'm hoping we don't need to go through and pass all the specific statutes that will change the implications of domestic partnerships. So
that was just I apologize.
No problem. No. I just think it needs to be checked out, but that clearly was not the legislative intent with the passage of House Bill 2007. So.
Okay.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Conflict of interest, when we have those in the state of Oregon, and I don't disclose that my brother happens to have this piece of property that's coming into the city for an economic gain, and I don't disclose that and recuse myself from the voting, isn't that against the law?
If you don't disclose it?
That's correct.
Correct.
Okay, so we have statute in place to address it in the first place.
Yes, correct? There are conflicts of interest statutes in Chapter 244, correct.
Okay. Second thing is complaints. Folks, we have people that file complaints right before the ballots come out. Let's not fool anyone. There are people out there, I know in Southern Oregon, of an individual that did it twice in a row, that filed an ethics complaint, and of course it comes out in the paper right at the time that the ballots hit, about an ethics complaint. This is being abused. So is there any way that we can stop that process? Like, you know, I mean, it's so, I mean, I'm going to give you an example. Filed an ethics complaint against an individual that was running, that was an associate broker, because the individual claimed on the voter pamphlet that they were a broker. Well, they were a broker. But the individual filed the ethics complaint that they were really associate broker instead of a broker. Now, they're both one and the same, but it was still an ethics complaint and it came out in a paper. Is there any, do you have any ideas of how we can prevent that from being used as a tool, a political tool for political gain?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Esquivel, the changes in 2007 actually allowed for public officials to delay a complaint to that it was filed within 60 days of the election, to delay it till after the election.
Okay.
So that was a step that was taken. Now, your comment about the public, you know, I mean, public disclosure of that to the papers or other type of media, you know, I don't have an answer for that, but there actually was addressed by, I believe, the Law Commission, and it is in the statutes. So there was a change made.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you all for enduring all of our questions today and coming to testify. We've been talking a lot about sitting elected or appointed officials. Can you talk about the applicability to candidates? Each of us have a whole bunch of local candidates that right now, in the next couple of months, are going to be filing for office in our districts. Can you remind us of the applicability of the SEI and or the quarterly report to them, and where it is applicable, what communication is happening to somebody who might file today for mayor in my city?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, if you were a candidate on 415, then you were required to file an SEI, or Statement of Economic Interest, along these acronyms. Mm-hmm. And if you did file a Statement of Economic Interest, then you will be responsible for a quarterly report as long as you are a candidate. And so there's a quarterly report that's due July 15th. There'll be another one due, I'm doing math in my head, October 15th. So if and we have contacted those folks, and they have filed. Now, new candidates that are coming in, you said people are going to file the candidates.
Right.
Remember, it's a very specific group of candidates that are required to file in statute. And I apologize, I don't have the statute in front of me. But so it's not every candidate that's required to file an SEI. It's very specific on which candidates that are required to file. So I don't know if you have candidates that are coming up that are going to be part of that group. And I can certainly check on that for you.
And Madam Chair, I think the main category are going to be for city elections.
Yeah.
So city council, mayor, in jurisdictions where there's not a May primary.
Representative Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, they're not required to file a candidate statement of economic interest.
And Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions, if I could. Mr. Person, if an ordinary citizen wants to file a conflict of interest complaint, they would do that with your office, is that correct?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Shields, correct.
And can I ask a follow-up or two, Madam Chair? I'll take that as a yes. In the last year or so, how many of those have been made, do you think, off the top of your head?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Shields.
Or three years.
I don't have the actual number of conflict of interest complaints. I think I provided that information to the ethics reform team, but I did not bring that with me. I can tell you just the total number of complaints that have been received, but I can't tell you that all of those are, well, I know not all of those are conflict of interest in the these are the total number of complaints that are actually formalized by the agency that have gone through the process. But in 2007, we received 66 that went through the process, and so far this year there's been 37.
Okay.
But I can get you that information.
I would, and if I could just
follow up, Representative Shields.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Make an observation. I think
one
of the key things we need to
just Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Shields, is clarification. That's those cases that have gone through the process. That doesn't mean that there haven't been complaints filed that are ultimately dismissed at the preliminary stages of either for incompleteness or that the filing, the complaint is not within the jurisdiction of the commission.
Okay.
I apologize, sir. I do have information here, but it's not broke down again by conflicts of interest.
That's all right. If you could just get the number of complaints and then the ones that go through the process. And I think the point that I wanted to make is well, one more question, then the point, if I could. The what options are available for the ordinary citizen to, if they think that somebody might have a conflict of interest, and what options are there for them to research that? In any documents within your purview that they can go to?
Representative Rosenbaum, Representative Shields, the Statement of Economic Interest is the document that my agency holds for the use by the public to look for those things.
Okay.
So that's the document that I have. Now there may be other, information out there that they can give, but as far as my agency, that's the purpose of those forms.
And I think the final point is that in my view, there's got to be some way, maybe this isn't the exactly perfect way to do this, but there's got to be a way for ordinary people to be able to connect the dots. If somebody says, if they don't declare a conflict of interest, how in the world would you know that one might exist out there and between somebody that they might have an economic interest in? And I think that's one of the key issues we need to keep in mind in this debate.
I think it's a really good point. And I mean, it highlights the fact this is a complaint-driven process, that in the past, largely, I think it has been not just complaints, but members of the press who have acted as a watchdog to enforce these laws. So it shouldn't be lost in this discussion that some of what we want to achieve, in addition to just making the law work well, we don't want to lose the original spirit of what we were trying to do, which was have ethics standards and a means of enforcing them. So certainly we're not trying to send the message today that we have these laws, but we don't care if anybody complies with them or not, because obviously we do. We just want to make sure that they aren't providing an undue hardship on the good people that step forward either to run for office or to volunteer for public service. At least that would be my view. Did you have any additional testimony?
I did not.
Well, thank you very much for being here today. And I believe at this point I will turn the gavel over to the good Chair Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what we will do at this point, given the fact that the House Committee has more work to do this afternoon, and we do not, although individuals may have, but this committee does not. The next two panels I will call up, as each panel, will go through their testimony, and then we'll take questions for the panel as a whole after they give their testimony. That way we hopefully can get done by about 1:15 would be my hope. So with that, I'll bring up the local government panel, which is Paul Snyder, Mike McCauley, and Genoa Ingram.
Oh, yeah.
And Paul, if you could go ahead and start off and each go through your testimony, and then we'll take questions at the end of your testimony. And I might state that the reason I think that both I wanted to note also Representative Cameron, who's here, who is also welcome to join us at the dais if he wants to be visible. If he doesn't, he can stay back there. But given back to this panel, the reason we put this panel forward, Chair Rosenbaum and I, is that we wanted to give an opportunity for several entities to at least comment on the earlier report that we heard. And we are going to have plenty of opportunity at future meetings for broad public testimony, and obviously individuals that come from these different organizations may appear at some of those opportunities to testify. So that's what we're doing here today, is to get their response to this report and also maybe anything else that they want to get on the record. Mr. Snyder, will you go ahead and start?
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, we wonder if Mr. McCauley might go first.
Okay. That would be fine.
Thank you. Chairs and committee members, I'm Michael McCauley, the Executive Director of the League of Oregon Cities. And we appreciate this opportunity to provide some comments. What we'd like to do is put a little bit more of a human face on what is happening out here. The numbers have been given to you before, but I'd like to reiterate them. Cities are where the firestorm is occurring. And it is a widely distributed issue. It's not an Eastern Oregon issue, a Willamette Valley issue, or a coastal issue. While there are more people who have resigned from entities that were not required to report previous to the 2007 legislation, it's almost an equal split. 27 cities previously required to report have lost officials. 42 cities previously not required have lost officials. That breakdown is 70 city council members and mayors, 110 planning commission members, 2 staff members, and 2 other commissions. It has impacted the city of Portland at $586,000 with resignation of a commission member, to the city of Richland with a population of 150 people. So it is widely distributed. As mentioned in the report, I think part of the reason the previously not required to report cities have had a higher number, though not necessarily a larger number of cities, is that wrapped up in the whole concept of the vote that occurred in 1974, that there are issues that those folks are facing in terms of what they see as an overturning of the elected of the election results in their community, so that it becomes a bit more complex. I think on a general comment with respect to the ethics review task force, that they did an excellent job of capturing and summarizing the issues and identifying what we see as some very worthwhile options for your consideration as you go forward. In putting some of the, what I will call, human face on this, public officials have made a very conscious choice to be transparent about things that most people see as very private information. They have made a conscious decision that certain parts of normal social intercourse and interaction are going to be regulated differently than it is regulated for the general public. We end up in a situation where their relatives have not made that choice. And we have very good people who have engaged in long-term public service that are going to be the second wave of resignations, who are waiting to see whether or not there is relief with respect to what they see as an overreaching invasion of their relatives. And that's coupled in with the Internet. So relatives and Internet, while they are, if you will, the most visible, have gotten the most press and coverage, have generated the resignations. The second wave of resignations that we are on the cusp of relates to the substantive rules that apply to relatives that are, in a sense, as was described by the review team, part of the whole philosophical underpinnings of this expansion to requiring reporting on relatives. Looking at that situation, you have people who have a relative who has chosen public service. As I indicated, it made certain choices about transparency, divulging information, who in the regular course of their business may well be receiving entertainment as part of their course of business. Example that I would give you is, if you had somebody who was in the construction industry, who as part of their job and duty would be to schmooze with folks at an industry golf tournament for which they're not paying because it's part of their job, well, it might be sponsored by somebody who has a legislative or administrative interest in their relative. And they have no ability to tell the relative, would you resign as mayor or council member or planning commissioner because I got to make a buck working in the construction industry. This is where I think we're seeing the overkill. What people are saying is that they don't see a real connection. And as the team was pointing out, many officials will look at it and say, if you say, I should go through an examination of conscience to ascertain folks that I know, as opposed to might or potentially, who I know have an actual principal financial interest in what's happening in my city, they don't particularly object to disclosing that because there's a connection. But as was outlined for you before in the report, there isn't a connection between describing a whole lot of relatives and anything impacting them. The concerns that city officials have are as real as some of the concerns of the judges. I think we're all aware of the Kirkwood, Missouri, where there were three council members killed and a mayor killed by a person who was dissatisfied with what was happening in the city. It's not the only time in American history that a local elected official has been the target of stalking or harassment. And so folks who are doing this public service are concerned about their families. I think any time that you interject yourself into a person's family, the reaction is going to lead off emotionally before it gets to the intellectual. But both intellectually and emotionally, it's very hard to come up with a connection for most of what's being asked with respect to relatives in the reporting requirement or in some of the substantive parts. We have people who serve on city councils who in their day jobs are corrections officials. So the same concerns of a correction official, a police officer, and some of them are police officers, carry over into filing as a city official. We have people who have relatives in the armed forces who are engaged in operations in which where they are or what they're doing or even who they are to a certain degree is not common knowledge and is not supposed to be common knowledge. We have people who are concerned because of many circumstances. One official wrote to us and said that she really had no problem filling out the form until she spoke with her children, who were concerned that somebody who might have a grudge against their mother would be looking into the fact that they were gay people and that somehow this would trigger perhaps a bigoted reaction trying to get to their mother through the kids, with no connection between what the kids were doing and anything the mother was doing on the council. As was mentioned to you before, we have people who are trying to be in compliance and they care about being in compliance who don't really know if they have relatives that they need to report. One person responded that his father left when he was about 10. The information floating on the grapevine in the family is that his father had remarried twice and had probably had kids in both remarriages. Hasn't had any contact since whenever. Technically, that person is in violation of the law as it's written because he is unable to really completely fill out that form. as was mentioned. We have folks that really have no contact with their relatives, and this is sort of kicking an emotional scab when they have to fill out a form and list the names of people that they haven't spoken to for 20 years, which, excuse me, without trying to undermine family and the importance of family, I think there's a fundamental premise here that somehow a wide distribution of relatives has some direct financial input. And looking at what was brought to you before about where you draw the line, it's going to be unsatisfactory and satisfactory. There's a lot of folks who have a lot more interest in their neighbors or in who they went to college with than their brother, who they may not like at all. We had a person who was also placed in the situation who resigned because she couldn't fill out the form with respect to the household because she lived with two of her siblings. And the siblings weren't about to give her the information so she could determine what the top five sources of income were. I mean, one of the conundrums in here in looking at people is that folks do not necessarily have a blended, transparent financial relationship within their household. One of the folks responded that she and her husband each use their own names. They each maintain their own business arrangements. And her husband was not going to give her information about his client list and put himself at a disadvantage. So, again, we're looking at transparency of the public official for the discharge of public duties to which they've agreed by becoming a public official, and their limited ability to compel third parties, be they spouses, domestic partners, or whomever, to disclose to them information necessary to fill out this form. What I'm telling you about is folks who are looking very seriously at the form with a real desire to comply with the law, finding the price of continued public service to fill out all of the information with respect to relatives too high for them to continue in public service. And a second group, as I mentioned before, that if this goes on the internet, and depending on where it's going, who are either not going to seek re-election or who will leave before the next filing term comes apart. I think there is a need, if not to follow one of the options of perhaps drastically reducing the whole relative requirement, to at least provide some ability for a person with special circumstances to have those taken into consideration. Another one was an individual who really didn't want to list as a household member not contributing to the household a brother that he brought in from out of state who was suicidal, who wasn't contributing to the income at all, but he really had this sense of his brother being embarrassed by showing up on this, but there's no source of income that would be associated with the brother while he's in that particular situation. The internet issue, the identity theft, is a real concern. When I was a city manager, I was regularly asked by city council members about various really weird email things and scams, and you know, the ones about I have $100 million if you just give me your bank account, but more than that type of thing. What happens to public officials as well as anybody else whose name and information is listed on a website is folks phish it. So if you take the phishing that already goes on that gets you information, and if you put, for a lot of folks and a lot of folks' relatives, their mother's maiden name on the internet in a searchable database with the Ethics Commission, I can fish over here and I can fish over there, and I get bits and pieces of information I would not otherwise be able to get. A lot of folks have responded that if a particular person wants the information and it's tracked and you have to go through it on them, that's fine. But this whole concept of being exposed to internet phishing, it's sort of that balancing endeavor of greater ease of access to information and the potential misuse of the information. other reporting issues that arise in this concept, one of the examples that was in the team's report was the military department during a natural disaster emergency trying to keep track of what was the value of transporting officials and what was the value of the stale donuts. And you would then be required to report that in 15 days. Again, looking at people wanting to get information on intergovernmental cooperation, things that are happening, it's all public data. So if somebody wants to know, for example, what did the League of Oregon Cities spend on board member travel so that they could operate an intergovernmental agency, they can already get it. But does it make sense to have 15 people file 4 reports on what they were reimbursed for mileage to do that when, if you wanted to see it, you could see it anyway? Especially in small cities, I think it's important to point out the great difficulty they have in getting volunteers. One city in responding indicated it took them a year to get somebody willing to serve on the city council before the new reporting requirements, and finding it even more difficult. Business owners who also serve in local office are facing this problem of trying to keep track of $1,000 or more of each and every purchase and transaction. And in the definition of the reporting requirement, this is the one for the SEI where it's anybody who reasonably could be anticipated to have an interest. It places the person at risk of penalty for not guessing correctly as to who might have business coming before the city, as well as putting the universe of people willing to serve in a volunteer capacity on a city council or planning commission much, much smaller. Because if you take the guy at the hardware store and say you need to keep track of every sale at the hardware store over $1,000, they're probably not going to be interested in undertaking the service. I would echo the comments that you received previously on the need for precision in legislative and administrative interest so that it would focus on people who actually have the effective ability to make decisions. The prohibition on gifts that applies across an entire governmental body are really unworkable. And part of the problem with this is that I think you have a lot of people in local government as well as in state government that are looking at ethical behavior, which is dedicated service without regard to personal gain or loss. Basic tenet of what the conflict of interest laws now require and apply, who are losing a sense of respect or buy-in to where the statutory scheme has gone, because we can come up with these examples that sort of defy what most people would see as common sense logic. For example, the sports league for the police youth league receives tickets in Portland so that you can take some youth that the police are working with trying to build community relations. They get free tickets to go to sports events. Well, with the agency-wide prohibition, the police officers can't get the free tickets to take the kids that they're trying to work with to go watch a sporting event. I mean, most folks look at that and we lose them. And when we lose them on some of what may be seen as the peripheral things that have been perhaps the unintended consequences, my fear is we lose some of the buy-in to the underlying principles of ethical behavior. Another example is the city of Portland had an engagement ring. Person works for a bureau that has nothing to do with licensing. And then the person with whom they're engaged has an interest in the licensing bureau. The safest way of viewing that is on an agency prohibition. It might be good for the guy if he can only buy a $49.99 ring. But you have that issue. Again, focusing in on specific situations involving decision makers gets us out of the situation of trying to impact volunteers, seasonal employees, you know, what have you. The complete prohibition on entertainment, and I think it's also addressed by the decision making, but we asked, and the Ethics Commission was very helpful in terms of trying to answer some questions and provide information that we placed out. And we did work with the Ethics Commission when the filing was coming in, as soon as we could get information, to take information from them and put it out so that we could dispel some of the misinformation that was floating out. But the question that was asked, and it shows up in our frequently asked questions on the website, I'm a city manager and my daughter has been invited to attend a movie with a classmate. The classmate's parents may have a special interest in the city I manage. May my child accept movie tickets from her friend? The answer is no. It's entertainment. There's an interest. And so this undermines, again, in terms of a common sense situation, what we're really trying to do. That you would say to what you'll have is compliance with some of this is going to be in the breach as opposed to non-compliance being in the breach. Because I don't know very many people who would tell their kid they can't go to a birthday party of a classmate because the classmate's parents have a matter pending before the city or might have a matter pending before the city. Planning commissions, I would submit to you, are a separate sort of group of folks, which may be something to consider looking at differently. Planning commissions by statute have to go through what I'll call an examination of conscience every time they meet to review things, to disclose actual conflicts of interest with respect to what is on the agenda at that time. And that's where we've lost the largest number of folks that are like, I'm giving up an evening or two a week, I'm listening to all this stuff, and now you're giving me this Bible to fill out and talk about my relatives, I'm out of here. And that again is, if we're looking at ethical behavior, they're already required to do that. If they're going to fudge, they're going to fudge on that statute, and they're going to be in trouble when it outs, because this stuff, and you can hide stuff for a while, but if you've got that type of conflict of interest, it's going to out.
Mr. McCauley, if you can finish up in just a few more minutes.
Thank you. Another issue with respect to precision, SEIs are required of chief administrative officers, and in a lot of cities, city recorders have only clerical duties and no administrative duties, and so we're having an impact on them as well. In conclusion, members and chairs, we have supported transparent government. We continue to support transparent and open government. We greatly commend to you the excellent work that was performed by the Ethics Reform Review Task, and the League looks forward to working with the legislature as you work on these issues.
Okay. We will go next to either Mr. Snyder or Ms. Ingram, and we'll go to questions right after that. So whoever wants to start first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Janoway Ingram, Special Districts Association, and also Oregon Fire District Directors Association. I have truncated my testimony in order not to repeat what has been said before, and in the interest of time, I'll move through that quickly. I first want to thank the Ethics Commission. They've been very responsive and I think very diligent in trying to implement a very difficult statute, and we have continued to be a part of the implementation through rulemaking. As late as yesterday, they were very quick to respond to a question we had. You may have heard there was testimony with regard to toy-like lighters and prohibiting the sale of those lighters that look like toys. And there was some concern from one of the witnesses. They wanted to give each member of the panel a toy and a toy-like lighter, but they didn't want to have to track the gift, as it were, and so they were not going to give those exhibits. And when I heard that, I was just appalled, and I said, no, there is an exemption in the statute for educational materials, and I believe that applies. I sent an email off to Mr. Crabtree and told him the urgency, and he responded within half an hour. So I just want to give them a thank you for doing that. A general comment, I guess I feel a little bit like Representative Berger. We spent nearly 2 years and $250,000 in the Oregon Law Commission study, and I had hoped that that body of legislation, those proposals, would have been the basis for the legislation rather than kind of having them pile on later. We were able to get as many of those on, and I thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, for your assistance in getting a number of those concepts included in the legislation. With regard to the SEIs, I guess I feel a little bit presumptuous sitting here before you today because, as you know, special districts were not included in the requirement to file the statements of economic interest. However, I can tell you that I did receive numerous phone calls, primarily from fire districts, because that is my area of most involvement. Sheridan, Siusla, they're probably not going to let me mention it, Amity, Sheridan, I said Sheridan, and one other called to let me know that their entire boards were resigning, and I was able to quickly say, wait, before you do that, please understand that you're not included. I did lose some library districts who I was not able, members who I was not able to get to prior to their resignations, and that was a difficult situation because we represent not just fire districts, but cemetery districts, library districts, water districts, and if you think there's no glamour in city council, try serving on a cemetery district or a library district, and I honestly believe that just requiring one more... When we call people and ask them to serve, they'll say, well, I don't know, how many times do they meet and what's going to be required of me? And if we tell them that they're going to have to file this form, you know, every quarter and all of that that goes with it, I do believe it would tip the scale enough that you would see even a greater negative impact on local government. And we appreciate the legislature listening to those arguments that we put forth last session and not including those small special districts in the SEIs. Obviously, there are problems. You've heard the problems with public safety concerns. I spend a good deal of my time, and those of you who have served on judiciary will bear me out, trying to exempt public official information and particularly personally identifiable information from the public disclosure records. And we believe that should this continue in the current manner, that it would set those efforts back quite a ways. I want to make sure that people understand the board member of a special district. They serve without compensation. They open themselves up to a great deal of personal liability with regard to the fiscal responsibilities that they undertake. I can also tell you, unfortunately, that most of the complaints that are brought forth are by disgruntled former board members or someone who thinks, gosh, the ambulance didn't get to my house fast enough, or the fire department didn't get to my house fast enough, and they start looking. Day before yesterday, very, very recent, did receive an email from an individual, a board member serving down Lane County, and it was an email from a constituent who said, I've been going through the public records, and I don't see an ethics filing for you, so does that mean that you're not in compliance? Just looking for something to complain about with regard to a board member. So it's a thankless job, something, again, they don't get paid for, and there's a great deal of liability for them. Much has been said about gifts. We believe that the Oregon Law Commission's take was correct, that their focus was not so much on a artificial limitation on the amount or the value of the gift, but to the reporting of gifts received. It was fascinating for me to sit with the Ethics Commission as they tried to promulgate rules with regard to gifts. We talked about things like if you take a public official out for a meal, should the table service, the linens be included? Should the gratuity be included in the value of the meal? There was a great deal of discussion about that, trying to get it right. I can just tell you the compromise that we offered to on the House side before the legislation was passed was to either raise the bar to $100 where it was previously, or to exempt food and beverage. If I don't like a public official,